You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Peter Werby. Peter Werby is, among other things, a radio host, and I have been a guest on his show many times, and it is an honor to have him finally on my show. You can find out about Peter Werby at peterwerby.com. Werby is W-E-R-B-E. But we are also going to be talking about the Fifth Estate, and you will want to check out fifthestate.org online. Peter Werby, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you, David, and likewise. It's a privilege. It's an honor. You've been such an addition to my talk show here in Detroit, so it's good to be on yours.
And I should say that Peter has, I think, played a role in getting this show aired on a station or two, which is always appreciated. This show is free to any station. Peter, we're here to talk about the Fifth Estate, which is a newspaper that was started 50 years ago. So it's, you know, this is something that's been active in opposing war since the Vietnam era, just like most living peace activists, I'm afraid, in this country. But maybe we should start with, where did this come from?
Well, as they always say, time flies when you're having fun. And it's been a pleasure, and maybe that word isn't even the best. It's been a rewarding experience to be involved on my part for a long time with the Fifth Estate. Was the newspaper, now it's in a magazine format, but we always call it the paper. There was a wave of oppositional papers that began actually in 1965 with five original newspapers that constituted themselves as what became called the underground press. And then it was actually the underground press movement. And by 1970, there were over 500 regularly appearing newspapers, tabloids, a lot of them weekly, in fact, most of them weekly, and had a total circulation, depending on whose figures you're looking at, of 4 to 5 million. So that was an extraordinary impact on particularly young activists of the day. And back in the day, back half a century ago, there were a lot of people opposing the war, demonstrating and protesting for civil rights, civil liberties, gay rights, women's rights. And that was all combined in these newspapers that, if you can imagine, you know, no internet. I mean, you and I lived when there was no internet. Now I can't even imagine how it was. But you actually had to wait for a tabloid newspaper to get some sense, rather than these journals of professional liars that would come out daily in our cities.
And 500 newspapers from the left, from demanding peace and justice and anti-racism and women's rights and so on, that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, that's 500 regularly appearing. And then there were all sorts of publications that would come out once. There were mimeographed. I don't know if people even remember that technology, just forgetting what it is, a pretty simple thing. But there were, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds more of high school newspapers, labor caucuses, neighborhood publications, all that were oriented towards, as you said, ending war, ending racism, ending gender discrimination, sexual orientation discrimination. And it was reflective of the times, obviously. I mean, everybody knows about the 60s. And, you know, I sometimes get the feeling that young people are, oh, no, they're talking about the 60s again. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just being too self-conscious. But preparing museum exhibits to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Fifth Estate newspaper, going through half a century of publications, of going from every period, from when it was a weekly till now, when it comes out only three times a year, the material in there and that reflects the opposition is absolutely amazing. And you can tell, I mean, one of the lessons is just how undemocratic this country is, because with all of the opposition at every level of society during the 1960s, the rulers, you know, continued their war, gave up, I guess, formal racism and formal discrimination against other groups in society, but still tenaciously hold on to those aspects of our society, particularly, as you know, David, is war. I mean, that's the cornerstone of this society. Militarism as a culture and militarism as the keystone of our economy.
Yeah, I guess, you know, there may be doubts arising that racism is formally even abolished with the proliferation of cell phone videos of police and the people waking up in sweats now afraid of Syrian toddlers and so forth. I mean, these are ongoing struggles. It may be that all of those radical publications could collectively have been called the Fifth Estate. Where did that name come from? I like the name, the Fifth Estate.
Well, now, of course, it's pardon me. It's was the name of that movie about Julian Assange, and the three people always say what. I mean, we're not fond of the name, but you know, it's always been there. Nothing that we could do in French society before the revolution. There was the general estates, which were the royalty, the clergy, and the common people. In the 1920s, someone said that the press was so powerful that it constituted a fourth estate, and I guess we one-upped it, huh?
I don't know if this was how it was meant, but I took the name to mean that the fourth estate wasn't doing its job, so that a fifth one was needed.
Well, in the case of the Fifth Estate publication, it was the name of a coffee house in Los Angeles in 1965 when the young founder of this publication was out there, and he said, oh, that's a cool name. And I asked him just recently, I said, did you put that because you saw that as implying just what you said? And he said, no, I just thought it was a cool name. But then there's also a band called the Fifth Estate, and the CBC has a news magazine called the Fifth Estate. The Fifth Estate newspaper actually wrote CBC in the 1970s said, hey, we've already got that name. Could you go find another? And they never replied. So anyway, that's the name we have.
And Peter Werby, who was that founder? Let's give him some credit and other men and women involved and yourself. When did your role start?
Well, I started pretty early. Harvey Obschinsky, who if anybody has seen Who Killed the Electric Car, Harvey's father, Stan Obschinsky, played a big role in development of that kind of battery technology for electric cars. And also Harvey Obschinsky was the 17-year-old that came back to Detroit and said, I want to start a newspaper like the one he had seen out in Los Angeles in 1965, the Los Angeles Free Press, one of the first ones to appear as part of the underground press movement of the 1960s. And it was a one-man show, 17-year-old and a couple of his brothers and sisters. And he connected up with the Detroit Committee to End the War in Vietnam. This was 1965. And suddenly, the thing just blossomed. The anti-war activists, artists, radical students, people that defined the 1960s, all of a sudden made this publication explode, along with ones that were exploding in every other, not even just major city, but so many cities. I mean, there were, you know, regular appearing newspapers, left underground papers, as they were called, in Kalamazoo, Michigan, in East Lansing, Michigan, places like that. So I often say the papers wrote themselves, and a couple of people said, what the hell does that mean? And I thought it was obvious, but what it means is that it was the zeitgeist. It was in the air. It was what happens at any period of contestation with power. It happened in the 1880s, 1890s, first part of the 20th century, happened in the 1930s, and it happened again in the 1960s. I don't really know how to measure the Internet, because it really took a movement to produce these papers, whether it was the labor movement of the 1930s or the radical union movement of the first part of the 20th century. For instance, in northern Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, the radical union, the industrial workers of the world, the IWW, or who they called the Wobblies, had a biweekly paper in the Finnish language that had a circulation of 30,000. This is up in these, you know, copper mining districts. And now, if you or I, David, wanted to put out a Finnish language blog, we could just do it, right? Just one of us.
I'm sure they had Swedish, Joe Hill's language, and Norwegian as well.
Yeah. So it was the movement itself that produced the paper, although it takes individual creativity, like Harvey Yavshinsky, the founder, had to actually put it together, to make it happen. In other words, I was around, but it never occurred to me to start a newspaper. But I jumped on pretty early, and those of us in the Detroit Committee to End the War in Vietnam also were heavily involved in it. In fact, the first issue of the paper was refused by the printer because it showed an American flag, and instead of stripes, it had bayonets. So this good patriotic printer in the home of the free and the land of the brave and the First Amendment refused to print it, saying it was unpatriotic. And then actually, interestingly, it was printed by a black nationalist, Reverend Albert Clegg, who in Detroit had founded the Church of the Black Madonna and who became pretty prominent in Pan-African and black nationalist politics, particularly in the Detroit area, but and the Republic of New Africa also, which is an organization from the 1960s.
It's an auspicious beginning, both the opposition to nationalism and that you didn't edit to please the printer. You went and found a different printer. We're talking with Peter Werby about The Fifth Estate, a publication that's now hit 50 years, and the website is fifthestate.org. Peter, I wonder if you can tell me where this quote comes from. The Fifth Estate supports the cause of revolution everywhere.
Oh, that would be our biographers, those who chronicled all our actions, the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Yeah, what's with them? What's their connection here?
Well, they just, in any free democratic country that welcomes, dialogue, you have a secret police. Oh, no, wait a minute. That's contradictory, isn't it? They were all over us, as were what was called the Detroit and the Michigan State Police Red Squad. The Reds were the commies of the day, and anybody who was the left of Mussolini fell into that category. And through the Freedom of Information Act and through a court settlement here in Detroit, we were able to gain a lot of these files, and there it was. And we thought, hey, nicely put, guys. The Fifth Estate supports the cause of revolution everywhere. We'll put it on our masthead, and just so you don't think we're plagiarists, we'll give you credit. So that's what it always says, FBI. And you know what? I'll tell you, David. Looking through files, and we haven't even talked about these museum displays for that here in Detroit. Two museums are having exhibitions about the Fifth Estate's 50th anniversary of publishing. One of the pieces is an FBI document about me, just saying what I do and what have you. And I was looking at other, because I got my file back, I was looking at other pieces of it, and it said former addresses. And it had my addresses back till I was 8 years old. And I don't know why they missed the earlier ones. But I kind of laughed. And then all of a sudden, this chill went down my spine, because as a white middle-class person, I felt pretty impervious to the threats that government represents. In other words, I wasn't a Black Panther who was going to be assassinated in his bed like Fred Hampton was in Chicago in 1968 or anything like that. Nothing could happen to me, right? But just a little twist in our country's history, and I could be looking through barbed wire, right? So yeah. It's pretty creepy, because activists in other countries don't get the latitude that we do, and that I became very, very aware of that.
Yeah, and of course, as far as I know, you were not violating laws, threatening anyone's safety, and this is the problem with the I'm not doing anything wrong, why should I object if they spy right on every move I make argument, is that the focus always goes on the people challenging, using the First Amendment, trying to use the right to speak and assemble, and it maybe didn't intimidate you and your colleagues for 50 years, but I bet a lot of people dropped out from the intimidation and the preemptive detentions and the threats that come with that sort of surveillance. But let's talk about the exhibitions and the marking of the 50th anniversary. There's another quote I saw in a Fifth Estate publication from Abby Hoffman that said to the effect, if they don't jail you and they don't kill you, they'll eventually honor you. Now, I don't know if that's actually a law of physics that applies in all cases, but is that what's happening now?
Well, that's extraordinary. Yeah, there's a very, very hip museum, if you will, in Detroit, the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. So the fact that there now is an exhibition going on until January 3rd there in Detroit with all these posters and pages and front covers of the Fifth Estate and photographs and what have you, that's sort of consistent with what they do. They like to be a little edgy. But that the Detroit Historical Museum, which is an old-line Detroit museum, now has the story of the Fifth Estate front and center in their main gallery. I don't know what to say. You know, I guess they don't think we're a threat anymore, because I was thinking, boy, after they set up this exhibition, and including all sorts of covers that I would think that in a museum that caters to school kids and suburban retirees coming in for the day to see the history of their great city, mostly expecting to see a baseball from Ty Cobb or the stuff, the arsenal of democracy for the World War II production, which is all there. And the old streets of Detroit, there they go, you know, and they look, and right in the center of the place are these Fifth Estate covers talking about revolution. So who knows? Maybe we've been defanged. I hope not.
Does it have that effect? Does it make the Fifth Estate less threatening and less powerful, like, you know, the peace symbol and the peace movement being used to advertise underarm deodorant? Does it somehow mainstream and neutralize and Santa Claus it?
Well, as you know, in fragile societies where the rulers feel that their control is so at risk, you publish a poem and suddenly, you know, you've been picked up by the secret police and tortured. Here, the capacity for sucking in opposition seems to almost be endless. So, yeah, we can call for revolution everywhere and call ourselves the enemies of the state and threaten its very foundations with what we write. And, of course, you know, we're not just theoreticians. We're political activists. We're involved in the movements of the day, the we being the staff people that are involved in this. So I keep thinking, gee, are we any different than we were when the cops broke into our place and stole our subscription list and went to our printers and said, don't print the Fifth Estate newspaper? But I don't know. I mean, maybe Abby Hoffman's right. They haven't jailed us, and they haven't killed us, and they are honoring us with these two museum exhibitions in Detroit.
So, is the result in any way increased visits to the website, increased circulation, and once people get there, is the content unchanged? Is the politics the same?
In the actual newspaper magazine?
Yeah,
itself?
is what you're publishing at the Fifth Estate the same politics as 50 years ago?
Well, I'll tell you, we have a lot of oppositional movements going on now, and you are so active in promoting those. You're a real treasure, David. I know when one does it, you just get the feeling, hey, that's just what I do. But one of the things, looking back on the Fifth Estate newspaper, I go, oh my God, we actually, we're part of organizing a huge demonstration in Detroit in, you know, fill in the date. The content, the only thing that's different is that it's the current Fifth Estate magazine, because now rather than coming out weekly, it comes out three times a year. It's a lot more theoretical. It has, what I would hope is that people would read critiques of this country, this culture, this economic system, the environment, and when they look at the world, that some of the questions we raise would be the ones through which they view the world as well. And I hope that doesn't sound arrogant, because one of the things, of course, that we want people to do is be critical thinkers and to just not accept what's the phrase, not given information, but, you know, the what's passed along.
Groupthink, common wisdom.
Certainly common wisdom. But I would say most of the readers are people that have a radical perspective on the world and have that sense that I don't know if they think that a new world is possible anymore, but it's certainly, well, there's the old anarchist, the old Spanish anarchist from the phrase from the 19 late 1930s, we have a new world in our heart, which is certainly still present in us. And actually, we were very, very influenced by Spanish anarchism that actually created a new world in the late 1930s, and which, if anybody knows about it, they call it the Spanish Civil War. Where fascism triumphed. But the Spanish anarchists created a virtually a new society and called it the Spanish Revolution. They collectivized agriculture, they collectivized industry, and ran it in a manner that most people would, as a matter of fact, think the way things should be, rather than authoritarian hierarchies, a common democracy, and respect for everyone. And whereas if you say anarchism or communism, people go, oh, you know, it's great. Mm-hmm. But if you just talk about, hey, we're all involved in the same project together, whether it's a community, or whether it's a factory, or whether it's a farm, and why don't we all get together and use our common sense of how things should be carried out, people go, yeah, that sounds cool.
And I think people see themselves as continuing those traditions in Spain, in huge cooperatives and in movements that have now had some success in Spanish government and in the government of Catalonia. And I would hope that people in the United States that are active now are looking to the tradition that goes back 50 years. And you can go to fifthestate.org and see the current issue and past issues and look at that tradition. I'll give you another headline from the Fifth Estate. Christ's body found, Easter canceled. Now, was there a sort of a serious promotion of atheism here, or just a desire to shock in any way, or is there a precursor to the Onion type of publication there?
Probably all of that plus several. Let me just as a parenthesis here.
Yeah.
When you gave the website, one of the things I would do is in gratitude for this interview and for the number of times you've been a guest on my Detroit talk show, I would offer all of your listeners a free sample copy of our brand new, which is just about to be published, 50th anniversary edition, and we're just actually preparing the mailing list. So if they could either go to fe@fifthestate.org or go to the fifthestate.org website, you can get to it from there, and we'll send you out a copy. It's a beautiful issue, and we've stepped it up a little because of the anniversary. But why did we publish? I don't know if you're looking at that, but it is a facsimile, a forgery, this Christ's Body Found, Easter Canceled issue of the Fifth Estate, of a hideous Detroit right-wing daily called the Detroit News. And one of the things that we always were about, we mentioned earlier about critical thinking, is people trust certain forms, and usually in this society, ones they shouldn't trust. So people trust the Detroit News. And then all of a sudden, we put out a forgery, essentially. Actually, the New York Public Library just asked us for a copy of it. They have whole bunches of those, like the Yes Men not so long ago put out.
Yeah, they copied you decades later with the New York Times.
With the New York Times thing, yeah. And so we did a number of those, including university papers saying that the university president had resigned. And in his statements, in the fake news account of it, we had statements critiquing the corporate university and its connection to militarism. and what have you. So this Christ's Body found Easter canceled. This was put in the news boxes. I guess they still have those, right? Yeah, you know, where you see the paper facing out. So that was the one that you saw. And a number of rascals the night before pasted them up on church doors as well. In fact, we heard that one preacher even preached using it, holding it up, saying, "This, you know, he has risen." And it is on display at the Museum of Contemporary Art, Detroit. So you got this Detroit News, you know, and it shows the feet of Christ with, you know, like holes in them. And I was there watching this student saying, how could this be? And he didn't even know who I was. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, this is Christ's body found. I said, yeah. He said, how could that be? I said, I don't know. It's in the paper.
Must be true.
Yeah, and he just looked so totally perplexed. I mean, didn't get it one bit. You know, how could the Detroit News say something so improbable? Well, it says improbable stuff every single day. It's based on improbabilities, right?
Absolutely, and it deserves that kind of critique to this day. All of these newspapers do. They get things right occasionally, and they generally get everything wrong. We have just a couple of minutes left. What are the prospects going forward for the Fifth Estate? How can people get involved? How can people support it? How can 17-year-olds today get engaged with something started by a 17-year-old 50 years ago?
Well, boy, we want 17-year-olds because we're already looking for people to run the 100th anniversary of the Fifth Estate. But pardon me.
So sign up now, right?
The newspapers, newsprint, papers, and particularly left and radical ones, are collapsing at a pretty fast clip and, you know, being undone by the Internet. We actually have a growing subscription list. We have growing circulation. And, you know, sometimes we, you know, again, don't want to invoke hubris, but say, boy, you know, there was 500 papers in the underground press movement in the 60s and 70s. Now there's only just us. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, the figure after one going down is zero. And I'm, you know, I do radio. You know, I do have a website of my own. You know, we do a lot of electronic stuff. But there is something about print because, you know, with all the work, David, that you and I do, it's gone pretty quickly because it's up there just in the air. Here, you take these papers, and half a century later, and people that are listening, you know, your audience, in their 30s, 40s, even their 50s, this goes back, you know, before they were born. You can go through these magazines and read these accounts of this movement of opposition to war and racism and discrimination that are there, and most of them, you know, some of them are dated, obviously, but the critiques are the same. I mean, you can read newspapers from the Industrial Workers of the World 100 years ago, and they're talking about capitalism and the oppression of labor. And
this fleeting medium here, Peter, not only will be gone, but it runs out of time. And we will have to encourage everyone to go to fifthestate.org and email fe@fifthestate.org and say, I'd like my free copy. Peter Werby, thank you very much for everything you do and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
You too, David. You're a gem.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, some are wondering if the fatal shooting of 14 people in San Bernardino, along with a chart in the Washington Post showing that the year so far has included more mass shootings than days, might be the push corporate media need to stop covering gun control as a some say others differ culture war issue and move toward approaching it as an urgent public health concern. A similar shift seems called for on abortion, which corporate media treat as first and foremost a debate, as though it can't be the subject of straight reporting. But if media's takeaway from the violent murders of three people at a Colorado Springs Planned Parenthood clinic by a man reportedly ranting about baby parts is that both sides need to tone down their rhetoric, then women and women's reproductive rights will be taking a step backward. We'll discuss the broader context for the Colorado Springs killings and how to move forward on reproductive justice with Jody Jacobson, Editor-in-Chief of RH Reality Check. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press. On November 26th, the Pentagon ought to have given thanks to the Washington Post for a turkey of a piece. Reporting on Russian military operations in Syria, the Post's Karen DeYoung wrote, quote, "The United States has also claimed that Russia has caused numerous civilian casualties with unguided munitions, gravity bombs dropped from the sky," close quote. DeYoung cites the spokesman of the U.S.-led coalition, Colonel Steve Warren, saying, quote, "This is the reckless and irresponsible, imprecise and frankly uncaring approach to operations in Syria that the Russians have taken on," close quote. And she adds in her own voice, quote, "In a report issued late last week, the London-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said it had documented 403 civilians, including 166 women and children, killed in Russian airstrikes, more than the 381 fighters from both rebel and terrorist forces it said had been killed. The U.S. military has acknowledged two instances where airstrikes against the Islamic State resulted in civilian deaths," close quote. So here we have U.S. claims that Russian airstrikes are killing civilians, backed up by statistics from a presumably independent human rights group. Meanwhile, when the U.S. government claims to have killed almost no civilians in its air attacks, the Post just takes their word for it. The British Guardian was able to come up with some independent tallies. Quote, "Air Wars, a project by a team of independent journalists, is publishing details of 52 strikes with what it believes are credible reports of at least 459 non-combatant deaths, including those of more than 100 children," close quote. Well, that was back in August. More recent tallies by Air Wars have the U.S.-led coalition killing at least 680 civilians and possibly as many as 975. By reporting the civilians killed by the official enemy while concealing those killed by the U.S., DeYoung is basically doing volunteer PR work for the Pentagon. We hope they at least saved her some pie. Well, such blatant water carrying looks almost subtle next to some of the Washington Post's foreign policy offerings. For example, see if you can puzzle out how the Post feels and wants you to feel about the new president of Argentina, based solely on the lead from what is not an editorial but an article from November 23rd. Quote, The stereotypical Latin American leader of the past generation has been a firebrand populist who could deliver hours-long impromptu speeches on television, painted the United States as the source of all evil, and had probably fought as a guerrilla in some steamy jungle. That type of leader, think Cuba's Fidel Castro, Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, or Argentina's Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, minus the guerrilla experience, is the opposite of Mauricio Macri, the understated engineer and Buenos Aires mayor who was elected president of Argentina on Sunday. Close quote. If you still need more clues, the article goes on to state that Macri's appeal, quote, stems in part from his lack of a strong ideology, a sharp contrast to Fernandez's fierce nationalism. Macri, a scion of one of the country's richest families, headed the soccer team Boca Juniors and is serving his second term as mayor of Buenos Aires, where he is known for sprucing up the capital, bringing in art and music performances, and adding bus lanes. He's the anti-Cristina, said Diego Guelar, a foreign policy advisor to Macri. He's a doer. That would be exactly his ideology. Close quote. There may be critics of the man here labeled a calm, fact-favoring engineer, but don't expect to hear too much from them in The Washington Post. And finally, in a piece picked up everywhere from the Seattle Times to the Knoxville News Sentinel, the Associated Press called the November 13th ISIS attacks in Paris, quote, the deadliest violence to strike France since World War II, close quote. The Atlantic concurred with that description for the horrific attacks that killed 130 people, calling them, quote, the worst violence on French soil since World War II and the worst in Europe since 2004, when coordinated blasts on Madrid's commuter train system killed 191 people, close quote. It does no dishonor to those killed in Paris last month to acknowledge that at least 200 people were killed in that city on October 17, 1961. It was nearly 7 years into the war for Algeria's independence from French colonial rule, and some 30,000 Muslims demonstrated in central Paris against a curfew imposed solely on Muslims. They were met by a police force led by Prefect Maurice Papon, who would later be charged with crimes against humanity for his collaborationist role in the Vichy government. In a 1997 story for the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, reporter James Napoli cited contemporary reports of demonstrators clubbed, beaten, strangled, and pushed into the Seine, of dead Algerians piled like cordwood on the street. The French government covered up the massacre for years. Official claims were that two or perhaps five people had been killed. Only in 2012 was a plaque erected to acknowledge the numerous Algerians killed during the bloody suppression of a peaceful demonstration. Media needn't worry that people wouldn't care about the recent attacks without the superlatives, and though much can no doubt be attributed to a lack of historical knowledge and just laziness, media still missed a meaningful opportunity to shed light on a hidden history and connect the present with the past. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. I'll give a little more information about FAIR later on in the program. It's a crime story, a culture war story, a debate about what gets called terrorism, and about presidential candidates' ability to rise or sink to an occasion. But for all the worthy stories being aired, the killing of three people at a Colorado Springs Planned Parenthood clinic by a man angry about baby parts hasn't quite become a story about women and our right to decide whether to have a child. With Colorado only the latest in a long, long history of attacks, how do we move the conversation off the dime of whether reproductive justice advocates have a right to be upset toward what must be done to secure an atmosphere in which women can actually exercise their full human and legal rights? Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief at RH Reality Check. She joins us now by phone from Maryland. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jody Jacobson.
Thank you for having me.
Well, of criteria by which journalism can be judged, I think anyone would say providing adequate context for events would be preeminent. So it would seem odd not to locate the November 27th murders by Robert Louis Deer within a context of months of serious contentions from serious people like Carly Fiorina, like Ted Cruz, that Planned Parenthood barters and sells the body parts of unborn children, as Cruz has said, or that is, as Mike Huckabee said, it's a kill-for-hire organization. I mean, it says something about media's approach to abortion that we have to argue that that's an appropriate context within which to understand these murders.
Absolutely. Look, we're in a period right now where we're sort of in what I call a battle of fundamentalism. Yesterday, we saw many people killed and wounded by a couple of people who we don't know their motivation or really where they were coming from or what they were doing. But we do know that they took violence into their own hands for what may well end up being a personal issue.
This is San Bernardino.
In San Bernardino. And last week, we saw a man go and attack a Planned Parenthood clinic, again, out of what he thought was his personal responsibility to attack healthcare providers. Where is all of this coming from? The Christian right in this country sees itself as preeminent and sees itself as creating the Christian law that it wants us all to abide by, which includes a very strict and regulated role for women, which absolutely does not include access to contraception, birth control, reproductive health care, or control over our own bodies, including abortion care. So you've got this atmosphere in which people like a deluded and violently aggressive person, as his past indicates, like Robert Deer, decides it's okay for him to take matters into his own hands. So I think there's a connection here. Whatever we're labeling these different things, there's a connection here between ideologies that are being spread and giving permission to people to take action based on their own grievances or perceptions and take matters into their own hands. And I'm very concerned about that because in the aftermath of the Planned Parenthood attacks last week, not only did the Christian right not take any responsibility, we saw several of the people in that community actually egg on perpetrators of violence, like Eric Erickson, who's the editor of Red State and is a Fox News contributor, literally said that he's surprised there aren't more people doing it. So I think we're in a really scary time because we're a country that is loaded for bear with guns and all sorts of other ammunition and firearms, and we are encouraging people to take matters into their own hands.
Well, there's a short-term and a longer-term historical context here. I mean, just in terms of sequence of events. In the short term, this clearly has some connection to the video by the so-called Center for Medical Progress that was released in July. There was actually a traceable effect, wasn't there, of the release of that video and threats to abortion providers.
Absolutely. For months on end, we've seen, again, members of the Christian right and the anti-choice community, which is increasingly one, using videos that were purposefully created for the purpose of defaming Planned Parenthood. These are heavily edited, deceptive videos that purport to show Planned Parenthood breaking the law when it comes to the donation of fetal tissue. Now, there has been really bad reporting on this because you've got this false equivalency reporting which says the videos came out and they blame Planned Parenthood for this. Planned Parenthood says it's not true. Well, let's be real here. There's been congressional committees and there's been at least 8, if not 10, state investigations, all of which have found absolutely no wrongdoing because there's no wrongdoing to be found. In fact, governors in several states undertook to take taxpayer money to, quote unquote, investigate Planned Parenthood's fetal tissue research in their state, in states where Planned Parenthood doesn't do fetal tissue research donations. So, I mean, talk about the absurdity of using this as a political tool against a women's health care provider. It's just one in a long series of attacks on Planned Parenthood. And what's happened with these videos, they were purposefully both created and then edited to make it look like there was wrongdoing. But then they were purposefully leaked out over a period of time as a method of trying to create a longer arc for this story, generate disgust and hatred against Planned Parenthood, and also leading up to votes in the Senate and the House to defund Planned Parenthood. So you've got a real strategy here. We already know that at least two, if not more, of the folks on one of the House committees that oversees these things saw these videos well before they were released and didn't look into whether they were true or not. So they knew what was coming. We have FOIA requests for communications around this to find out who knew what when, because it says something that these congresspeople were shown these videos. We don't know if they saw the unedited versions or the edited versions. We don't know what was behind it. But, you know, here we have collusion between a group that has no credibility to begin with, likely obtained these videos in an illegal manner in the state of California, used false IDs, and then infiltrated clinics and meetings and secretly taped people and then heavily edited the videos to make it look like something was going wrong.
Well, you point to a real media phenomenon there, even outlets that themselves debunked the CMD video that stated flat out that it doesn't show what it purports to show, that people are actively disinforming. Even those outlets will now report matter-of-factly on mischaracterizations of the video, you know, because that's a thing that happened, someone said that, without acknowledging that doing so lends it some legitimacy, you know, by tacitly allowing something that is untrue to be presented as debatable.
Exactly.
Reporters are lending it an inappropriate legitimacy that's volatile, that you might even say is weaponized. You know, they make themselves, I think, part of the problem here.
Exactly, because what it does is it suggests there's an open question where no open question exists. You're not only suggesting there's an open question, you're taking the word of a heretofore unbeknownst organization on the board of which is a known right-wing abortion terror encourager. That would be Troy Newman, who's the head of Operation Rescue, and who has said that, you know, he's just A-OK with the execution, in his words, of abortion providers. And you are making them a credible voice on an issue that they have just demonstrated absolutely no credibility. So to me, it's the height of irresponsible journalism wrapped up in some sort of journalistic integrity flag, and it's not. It's not. There's no integrity in it.
I was going to ask you about Troy Newman. He's the board member of this Center for Medical Progress and president, as you note, of Operation Rescue. That ties this latest video in a way to the longer history that we know of clinic attacks. And we're not talking about, you know, I've seen some a brief look back items in papers, but we're not talking about a couple dozen incidents over the years.
We are talking about, in terms of the violence that's been perpetrated against providers, we are talking about not only a history of violence, but also what the FBI itself has noted is an increasing threat of violence and an increasing trend of violence, meaning that we're actually seeing increased violence aimed at providers. So you've got arsons, you've got shootings, you've got anthrax letters being sent, you've got intimidation and harassment, docking of providers has risen, you've got these flyers that are made up to look like wanted posters that give the private information of providers and clinic workers. You've got all of these kinds of practices of outright intimidation that, while of course they are in some ways protected by the First Amendment, because they are inciting violence, now we know clearly they're inciting violence, I think have to be looked at from the point of view of what the real intention here is. In California, for example, there's a law that enables providers of abortion services and reproductive health care to keep completely private all of their personal and other information. And it adds a measure, it's not a certainty of anything, but it adds a measure of safety for those folks. Whereas in other states, that not only does not exist, but in some states, they've tried to actually make the personal information of providers and clinic workers more available to those who would do them harm, which, again, I feel like is incitement to violence and intimidation. So I find it really troublesome that this is not a fringe group exercise. This is a collusion with legislative and other folks who are in power, who are policymakers, lawmakers, attorneys general, who have it out for reproductive health providers and have done their best to lay the groundwork for anti-choice terrorism and anti-choice intimidation.
Well, the attacks, as we're saying, aren't new, and neither is some media's inappropriate search for balance. Ted Koppel introduced a 1993 episode of Nightline on clinic violence by comparing the number of legal abortions with the number of murdered doctors, calling that the latest casualty count from the battlefront between the pro-life and pro-choice movements. Among many other things you might say, that toting up of values completely erases women, of course, you know, and now we get, in the present day, this sort of both sides should tone down their rhetoric line. The New York Times says, quote, Planned Parenthood has fomented political passions on both the left and the right in Washington, close quote. It seems, again, for media, it's a two-side story. It's not a human rights story. It just isn't framed in that way.
Exactly. That is exactly right.
Well, Jessica Valenti, in writing for The Guardian, pointed to a problematic response from many reproductive rights supporters, which has been to say, oh, but abortions are only a small fraction of the services Planned Parenthood provides, you know, which is true enough. But as Valenti put it, the attacker wasn't there because he was angry about pap smears, you know.
Right.
I feel that we are at the point where weak defenses of abortion rights, as Katha Pollitt very roughly paraphrased puts it, we can have it as long as everyone feels terrible about it. You know,
right.
Those are virtually non-defenses at this point. How do we move into a positive, proactive position on this?
Well, that is a question that is very heavily and broadly debated in the pro-choice community right now, because there are many of us, myself included, who are not only unapologetic about abortion care, but are unapologetic about their own abortions and want and try to speak out both personally to open the space for other people to do so, but also to encourage women and others, the men that have supported them, the families that have supported them, to speak out about their abortions, because it is one of the most common procedures that is undertaken in the United States. And, you know, it is a human rights issue. It's also a public health issue. It's a public health issue. And we are so unused to talking about that. But in countries where access to legal abortion is not available, one of the leading causes of death will inevitably be complications of unsafe abortion. So when I say that, I mean, to be more specific, one of the leading causes of maternal mortality of women between the ages of 18 and 49. So this is a public health issue of tremendous proportion, and we can't ignore that aspect of it. It's both public health and human rights, and we talk about it as though we're only a fight of ideologies, but it's really on the, as far as I'm concerned, to be pro-choice is a medically required approach, a public health required approach to healthcare, because if you don't have access to abortion, women die in higher numbers. And we've already got a problem in this country with high rates of maternal mortality, far higher than many other countries on the same level of economic and social development. So, you know, the fact that we're debating things like access to contraception and abortion care just goes to show you how disrespected public health is as a key issue.
Well, finally, in the wake of the Colorado Springs attacks, we have had a lot of conversation about how these are meant to harass providers. These attacks are meant to harass providers. They're meant to threaten women. But the response from providers, it seems, is not getting the intended effect. Providers have come out and said, you know, we're going forward undaunted. Is that not true?
Some of the larger providers do rely to a greater extent on the services they provide and the reimbursements they get from Medicaid. And there's good reason that they are concerned about those, because there are people that are served by those services and they deserve to be and need to be served by those services. But when you are trying to deal with congressional representatives and others and you are trying to work around their concerns, you might downplay things like abortion care and what share of your services is abortion care. In the long run, as you noted earlier, that is a really bad strategy, because it seems to say, as you noted, there's something wrong with this, so we're not going to talk about it. Whereas now we're seeing more and more providers saying, I'm an abortion provider. I am proud of the work I do. I serve women. This is why I do this. I think we saw that beautifully done in an op-ed in the New York Times by Dr. Willie Parker, who is a provider of abortion care, who travels extensively every week to make sure that women in certain states can get access to abortion care, who's very dedicated to being open about the work that he does, which, let's face it, puts him at no small risk of some fanatical person potentially attacking him. But the bravery with which he's acting is something that has given a sense of renewed openness from other providers as well.
We've been speaking with Jody Jacobson of RH Reality Check. Find their work online at rhrealitycheck.org. Thank you so much, Jody Jacobson, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find those on FAIR's website. That's FAIR.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network, to subscribe to our newsletter, which is called Extra, and to show support for the organization if you're so inclined. And we thank you for that support. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
The future will be radically different from the present, and it will either be radically different because we have significantly, you know, we've grasped the nettle and we've been prepared to make the sorts of changes that initially will be quite challenging socially and politically to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions, or a little bit further down the line, we will be faced with huge social and political repercussions because of a very significantly changing climate.
That is Kevin Anderson. As one of the world's top climate scientists, he says the hard facts about climate change are not getting out and never made it to the Paris climate talks. It's a shocking, revealing interview. Then we'll travel to Australia, where host Vivian Langford of the Beyond Zero Emissions show talks in studio with David Spratt, author of Code Red, plus a union icon and psychologist, on the eve of the Paris talks. More Frank Talk. I'm Alex Smith. Buckle up. This is Radio EcoShock. During the Paris climate talks, one leading scientist says the fundamentals of the whole process is wildly optimistic. It starts with climate models that assume too much, spills into unreal scientific advice, and ends with rosy media reports saying we can keep on growing without wrecking the climate. Our Western lifestyles won't be too greatly inconvenienced, they say. The odd man out at the party is Kevin Anderson. He's a well-known professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester. Anderson is also the deputy director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research, a leading scientific institute not only in Britain but in the world. Kevin Anderson, it's an honour to have you here on Radio EcoShock.
It's my pleasure to join you.
Well, last summer we broadcast a speech you gave, believe it or not, in 2012 at the Cabot Institute. It was very popular. But I'm calling you today about a new article you published in the journal Nature Geoscience. The title is Duality in Climate Science. What is the duality?
This duality really relates to a particular group of us in climate science. So it's less the people that we imagined in the very detailed fundamental research, and more those of us that work on the cusp between the climate science and the policy realm. So typically it's the group of people, and there's a very large, significant group of climate scientists who develop what we call emission scenarios. We think about what the future may hold in terms of our levels of carbon dioxide emissions, the type of energy systems that we're going to be having. And we link that to the climate science. And that particular group of scientists, of academics, that's where this duality is occurring, whereby our own understanding of the climate science tells us a story that really is very challenging and in many respects, you know, has potentially quite dire repercussions for the future. And because we're also aware of the political and the economic framing of our society, we then translate that scientific message directly. So we end up adjusting, massaging the message to fit with the current economic political framing. So and we don't always necessarily do this consciously. I think it's a real challenge for us to recognize the severity of what our climate science tells us and play that out against the day-to-day lives in which we live. So I think what we've got is this duality whereby we're reluctant to be directly, you know, candid and clear about what the science says in terms of what we need to do for policy. So our science has really very significant political repercussions, and we are steering a dangerous path in that we are not prepared to tell our policymakers, our paymasters, the direct indications of our own analysis.
Now, the stated goal for the Paris climate talks is to keep global mean temperature rise below 2 degrees centigrade from pre-industrial levels. Dr. James Hansen says it's crazy to say 2 degrees C would be safe. What do you think?
Well, actually, I have to say I do agree with Hansen on this. When we say it's safe, if we're really blunt about this, what we really mean by that is that a group of rich, white, typically men, have come up with a threshold between what we consider to be acceptable and dangerous climate change. And what we mean by that is that people like us, the relatively wealthy in the world, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, but elsewhere in the world as well, other wealthy groups, think that we can deal with the repercussions of 2 degrees centigrade. We can insulate ourselves from those repercussions because we have the wherewithal, we have the wealth and the educational framework and so forth to deal with those impacts. If you're poorer and live in the southern hemisphere in a more climatically vulnerable zone, then you are going to find 2 degrees C is certainly going to be well into the dangerous category. Many people will have their lives severely impacted. Indeed, many people will die as a consequence of a 2 degrees C temperature rise. And undoubtedly, some people are already dying as a consequence of the 1 degree C temperature rise we've already seen. So whether 2 degrees C is safe or not depends upon where you're coming from. And I think that given that the people who are going to be impacted by climate change are a group of people that have had very, very little to do with causing the problem. In other words, their emissions are incredibly low. There is some sort of moral imperative, in my view, that when we determine what is safe or dangerous, that we should err on the side of the poorer, the more climatically vulnerable, rather than the rich and the wealthy. But we have gone the wrong way on this. So 2 degrees C, I share Hansen's concerns for perhaps slightly different reasons, that it is probably too high a threshold. Having said that, I think now it is the best that we can hope for. And even at 2 degrees C, we are going to struggle to stay at that temperature.
Well, here's another thing that drives me crazy, and you describe it in your new paper. The question too often set to be answered is, what do we need to do to have a 66% chance or better of staying below 2 degrees C? Now, if we were playing Russian roulette, we have a pistol, we have only three chambers, and one of them contains the bullet. The stakes are not just our own lives here. As you know, it's all our descendants, possibly much of life on Earth. Who in their right mind would pull the trigger with only a 66% chance of surviving?
I mean, that is completely true. And in fact, most people are bought into the idea that climate change is serious. Now, but the problem is we're not prepared to accept the repercussions. So there is this, what I often call cognitive dissonance. We hold these two positions together. So it's not just the climate scientists here. There's all of us, because we realize that the repercussions of letting emissions continue as they're going now, and even reducing them at the sorts of levels we're talking about in Paris, which are still far removed from what's going to be necessary. We know that we're heading in a poor direction in terms of the climate and the temperature. But we also know that to get ourselves off that pathway is going to have very significant implications for how we live our lives. So we hold these two contradictory positions because it is too difficult to put them together and start to recognize the challenges that we actually face. So we are actually putting that gun to our heads, but we're almost looking the other way whilst we're doing it. So we're keeping our fingers crossed. We're doing everything else we can to, which is obviously not any real action, but just to try to pretend that the problem is not really that severe. And I think the climate scientists, this particular group that I outlined before, are party to that as well, that we have fed into, I called it yesterday when I was doing an interview somewhere else, a consensus of apathy, that we're not really prepared to recognize the severity of the science and then start to bring about the sorts of scale of changes that would be necessary. So I can understand why we're doing it, and you know, we're all optimistic. We don't really want to see ourselves as the fundamental cause of the problem. We want the problem to be solved by technology or by someone else. And everyone is in that same situation, and no one has been the first person to stand up and say, right, we need some action. So we are, in a sense, it's a tragedy of the commons. It's probably the best way of seeing this.
Tell us about the bias in modeling that provides optimistic pathways for cutting emissions.
Well, every year that we've failed on climate change, and let's be clear, this year in 2015, the carbon dioxide emissions in the atmosphere that we put into the atmosphere for this year would be 60% higher than when we first started to concern ourselves with climate change. For instance, when the first IPCC report came out in 1990, so 25 years later, after 25 years of apparent concern and knowledge on climate change, our emissions this year would be 60% higher. So we're now in a position where we've used up almost all of the carbon budget, that's the total amount of carbon dioxide that we can emit into the atmosphere, for this 2 degrees C temperature threshold that we've all signed up to. And what we have to do now, what the scientists who are producing these scenarios and these models, what they are doing now is, rather than saying, well, we are going to require significant social, political, and economic change, they have dialed in a new technology. This technology, which is often referred to as BECCS, Biomass Energy Carbon Capture and Storage, in isolation almost sounds like it makes a little bit of sense. But when you start to think of the scale at which they're applying it, it is incredibly dangerous. So what is being assumed is that because we're not prepared to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions, our use of fossil fuels in particular, what we are now claiming is that we're going to suck the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere at some point a long way off in the future, which allows us to maybe not quite business as usual, but at least not to have to make the significant changes that would affect our lives, so we can still make the statements that the current framing of Western society is perfectly reasonable to continue with a few efficiency improvements and a little bit of a shift towards renewables, which is the sort of rhetoric we're hearing. That is permitted because we're going to suck this carbon dioxide out, and we're going to do that by growing lots and lots of biomass, trees and other forms of plant material all around the globe. We're going to harvest it, we're going to burn it in our power stations, and then we're going to capture the CO2, the carbon dioxide that goes up the chimney, and we're going to almost liquefy that carbon dioxide and store it somewhere very deep underground for the next few thousand years. But as these plants grow, they suck the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and as we then capture the carbon dioxide in the chimney in our power stations, we're effectively sucking the CO2 out of the air. In isolation, in a lecture room somewhere, that sounds like it makes a little bit of sense. When you start to think of applying that at the planetary scale that we're talking about here, when you're also trying to feed 7 to 9 billion people, when every other sector is expecting to use biomass, the aviation sector assumes it will be flying its planes using biofuel, the shipping sector thinks it will be using biomass, the chemical industry thinks it will be using it as a feedstock, and this new technology called BECCS will be sucking the CO2 out of the air. Then you start to think we live in a round planet with a limited amount of food availability, a limited amount of land. You put these together, and there are many serious natural scientists are very concerned that this simply is not viable. This is a ruse to allow us to carry on our current way of living, and it will ultimately... It's a very dangerous ruse because it means that we're going to breach our 2°C carbon budget. We're probably going to breach 3°C and head towards 4°C. And it is very likely these technologies will not succeed. So that's the approach that we're taking at the moment. It is the new technique that allows us to carry on living lives as we're doing now.
Could you take as long as you need, really, to give us some of the numbers from the budget? I mean, I don't personally think the planet has any acceptable carbon budget left, but that's me. But let's assume the numbers provided by the IPCC for these climate talks are right. What are they saying we can burn, and how does that break down in the real world?
Okay. Well, first, I have to say I think I agree with you that we have no carbon budget left for what I would say is a morally acceptable, safe level. We have seen 1 degree temperature rise already, and we know that people are being severely impacted by that as it is today. Having said that, as I said before, I think 2°C is the best we can aim for, and the IPCC have been very clear about this. They have provided us with a series of carbon budgets for different chances, different probabilities of 2°C temperature. Now, whether people are familiar with the numbers or not here, but the headline number that the IPCC has provided from the wealth of science that it considers is 1,000 billion tons of carbon dioxide, a lot of carbon dioxide, between about 2010, 2011, out towards the end of the century. And that is the total amount of carbon that we can put into the atmosphere for a 2°C rise across this century. But the first thing to note here, and it's really very important, this, is that that 1,000 billion tons of carbon dioxide starts from about 2011, and we're now in 2015. We're almost at the end of 2015, and we've emitted about 140 to 150 billion tons. In other words, about 15% of that budget has already been used between 2011 and where we are today. So that's a significant part already gone in just a few years. You then have to think also that when my focus has been primarily on issues of energy, so producing the energy we need to live our lives. But we also have carbon dioxide emissions from the production of cement, and very large levels from the production of cement. It's not just from the energy used to make the cement, but the actual process of making cement emits carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And if you think that through in some detail and how important cement is to our lives, I've heard from the cement industry that cement is the second most used material on the planet after water. We use huge quantities of cement. It is in pretty much all of our buildings, our infrastructures, whether it's roads or rail networks, whether it's the foundations for wind turbines or for nuclear power stations. Virtually all of the major structures that we build in the West and increasingly in the poorer parts of the world rely upon cement. And even if you're very optimistic about what will happen there, then that takes probably about another 15% of the carbon budget away. And then finally, there's the issue of deforestation, that we should try to stop deforestation as quickly as is possible and some of the other land use changes. But it's still, I think it has to be said, realistically, we know we're not going to stop deforestation tomorrow morning. And therefore, there's going to be some additional carbon dioxide emissions as we slash and burn some of the forests around the globe. Now, let's hope we can reduce that deforestation as quickly as possible. But nevertheless, I would suggest you're talking about another 50 or 60 gigatons, possibly even as high as 100 or 150 gigatons, billion tons. So that's another somewhere between 7 and 15% that has gone. If you take all of that into account, what you have left is not 1,000 billion tons of carbon dioxide, but only 650 billion tons. In other words, a very significant reduction, about 40-odd percent, almost a 40% reduction in the total amount of carbon dioxide we have available. And that has huge political repercussions when we think that through in terms of, well, what then do we need to do to survive within that sort of carbon budget? And if we think of the budget a bit like our bank account, if you had £1,000 in the bank and you came to spend it on something, you found that £400 had already gone missing, or dollars, sorry, I should say, $1,000 in your bank account, and you came to spend it and £400 had gone, then you'd be severely constrained on what you could spend your money on. And that's the position we find ourselves in on climate change. And additionally worrying to that is that we are using up our carbon budget at a very, very fast rate. So this year alone, we'll probably put somewhere 35, 37 billion tons of carbon dioxide will go into the atmosphere. And every year we're using that much carbon. So if you put all of that together, this is why I'm coming down to with a conclusion that it is not just about technology that will solve the problem. It is actually about huge social and political change that is essential if we are to deal with climate change. And even if we don't, even if we're not prepared to deal with climate change, then there will be huge social political repercussions anyway, because we will be hit by the impacts of unchecked climate change.
Yes, you're calling for a revolution in our energy system instead of the sort of gradual evolution and transition being talked about in Paris. Is that right?
Yes, certainly. I think the language that's been used in the build-up to Paris over the last year or so has been very misleading. You often hear people, in very senior scientists, often saying that we will have to phase out fossil fuel use by the end of the century. We have to phase out fossil fuel use by about 2050 if we're really serious about the 2°C carbon budgets. And that's a very different time frame. And I think the reason people have not been keen to say that, because then that again has direct repercussions on our political system today. As 2100 feels like it's so long away, we can certainly await lots of new technologies. But 2050, and we think about phasing out all of our system today, well, that brings it much, much closer to home. When we think that any new power station that we build today will still be running in 2050. So from an infrastructure point of view, from a power station point of view, then 2050 is really just around the corner. So we're all aware then that we have to make sure that whatever we build today has to be very low carbon. So if we look at the UK, for instance, just in the last 2 weeks in the UK, the government has proposed building of up to another 25 to 30 gas-fired power stations. Now, gas has a very high carbon footprint. When you burn gas, you get a lot of carbon dioxide. Those power stations will run for 25 to 40 years. That means that we are locking in the UK to continue to use a very high carbon energy source for the next 3 or 4 decades. Now, that is completely incompatible with what the carbon budgets are requiring from countries like the UK. So you can see that you have immediate political repercussions if we're honest, direct and candid about what the carbon budgets are telling our policymakers and our society today.
Well, if the world energy budget is already close to climate bankruptcy, and we have a lineup of billions of people who expect to join this party of cheap energy slaves, somebody, Kevin Anderson, somebody somewhere is going to have to give up carbon privileges. Who?
Well, very fortunately, the last few weeks, I've also seen a new publication from two people called Chancel and Piketty. Piketty being quite famous for some of his economics work over the last few years. And they've looked at the carbon dioxide emissions around the globe and who those emissions come from. And what's very clear from their work, and it's the sort of arguments that myself and a few other colleagues have been making for at least 10 years, is that the lion's share of the emissions come from a very small percentage of the population. So if we are serious about climate change, it's the people who are the high emitters today that need to make radical changes to how they are living their lives in the short term to bring their emissions down. I'm not sure this is what you're implying this, but certainly a lot of people will read into what you were saying that, yes, but the poor of this world also want to become wealthy and also want to become high consumers and use a lot of energy like the wealthy ones of us do today. Now, that may well be true, but the poor of the world will not be wealthy enough in the time frame that we have to deal with 2°C for their emissions to be very significant. So actually, when you really look at the carbon budget and the time frame that we have to respond for 2°C, then, you know, very unfortunately, the very obvious people that have to make the largest change are the high emitters today. It is the level of consumption by people like me and probably yourself, maybe some of your listeners, that these are the ones that have to make these huge changes. Some of the work that Piketty pulled out, and the numbers are quite interesting here, in that he looked at the top 1% of high emitters in the US, and they emit over 300 tons of carbon dioxide per year. Then I think he looked at the bottom, I think it was the bottom 1% in Nigeria, as I recall, and I think they were somewhere about as low as 0.15 tons. So you start to see differences that are several hundred, if not several thousand times different in the levels of carbon dioxide emissions amongst individuals living on the same planet. And if we are serious about 2 degrees centigrade, it is very clear that as well as making a radical move towards low carbon energy supply, and that is, you know, that will be a revolutionary shift, and that means no more fossil fuel stations being built in the wealthy parts of the world, then at the same time, we must also reduce our energy consumption by those of us that are wealthy. And that is not just the people in the US or in the EU. That also includes, you know, about 300 million people in China who consume energy and therefore emit carbon dioxide at levels very similar to those of us within the US and the EU. Nevertheless, there are also about 1 billion people in China who have very low emissions. But it, so it's the high-emitting people around the planet who are probably not more than more than 1 billion of the 1 to 1.5 billion of the 7 billion on the planet are the high-emitting people that need to make those significant reductions in the short to medium term.
I wonder, are we asking too much of our scientists? I mean, they signed up, some of them, for research, and now we want them to become public battlers. What do you think?
Well, that's a very fair question, and I think that, and I have a lot of sympathy and understanding for my colleagues who do not really want to put their head above the parapet. You know, they're signed up to be, to say, scientists and academics. They want to do their work rigorously and carefully, and they don't really want to get into the political fray that as soon as you put your head up, you're criticized by one set side for one thing and you're criticized by the skeptics for another thing. So I really do understand that difficult dilemma. Nevertheless, climate change is an existential problem. It's a problem about our existence. It has huge implications for human lives and ecosystems around the planet. And I think sometimes we have to park our sensibilities and start to be a bit clearer about what our analysis is telling us. I'm not saying that we have to get involved, that scientists should necessarily get involved in playing politics, but there's a very big difference between playing politics and describing very clearly what the political repercussions are of our scientific analysis. And it's that part that I think that the scientific community, maybe not every scientist, but the scientific community has to come together and ensure that it does very clearly spell out the political repercussions of what our science tells us. Now, that's quite different from playing politics, but nevertheless, it is, you know, it does have a very strong political goal or political flavor to what we have to do. And that is going to be challenging for us because, as you say, you know, most of us have signed up to not get engaged with this sort of way of thinking about life. We want to carry on with our science in a robust, objective fashion within universities and so forth that we have done for many years and not get involved with the mucky, dirty work that the world that is outside of our laboratory doors.
If we assume, Kevin Anderson, that the Paris talks end with voluntary aspirational goals, talking about action by 2070 or beyond and not reached anyway, where do we go from here? Should we abandon this COP process? It's been going on for a long time and emissions keep climbing. And if we did abandon it, what could possibly replace it?
Yeah, I am actually very much in favor of the COP process, but I think to think that that is the only game in town is really very mistaken. At the risk of, there's a certain risk for me talking from the EU here, but I personally think we should have parked the US a long time ago on climate change. When the US decided not to proceed with Kyoto, I think the rest of the world, where, of course, by far the majority of the population live, we kowtowed to the US, and I think that was a real mistake. We should have said, right, we will get on with this, with dealing with climate change. We will have bilateral agreements between the Chinese and the EU and so forth. And if the Americans or some of the American cities want to come on board, as undoubtedly some cities would have done so, then I think we'd have made a lot more progress. I think we have pussyfooted around trying to keep the US particularly on board on climate change for far too long. So we could have taken a different route to the one that we have taken. But we are now where we are in 2015. And it still seems to me, though, that we are being very cautious in our approach to make sure that we keep everyone on board. And by doing that, or to do that, we are so significantly reducing the level of our aspirations that we are going to be heading for much, much higher temperatures. To say then that we should just dismantle that approach, I think, is a mistake. I think we must continue with COP. I think what happens at Paris is incredibly important. But it is not the only game. We have to pursue everything else that we can. I personally think that the EU should have engaged very thoroughly a long time ago with the Chinese to ensure that the EU, which is, I think, about one-third of global trade comes into the EU, as I understand it, it should have set up carbon standards for all of the imports and exports and all of the goods it produces within its own boundaries that are in line with 2 degrees centigrade. And it should have said that anyone who wants to import or export or import into the EU has to meet those standards. Now, this would have huge repercussions for WTO, for the new TTIP and so forth, if that goes ahead, for the 1944 Chicago Agreement that means the EU cannot put taxes on aviation fuel for planes that come in and out of the EU. We have to question these great global agreements that are stopping parts of the world put in place the structures and mechanisms that could drive their emissions down. So is that clear what I'm saying there, or is that something I should go over again there, do you think?
Absolutely clear, and I have to agree, and I think there's some ideas that will be novel for our North American listeners in what you just said. Well, as we wrap up, what kind of reaction are you getting from the scientific community to your new paper, Duality in Climate Science?
Well, going by my emails, generally very positive. So, and this is often the case that privately I get a lot of support, and I've recently come back from a sort of fairly lengthy trip around talking to various climate modelers and others, integrated assessment modelers and other groups around Europe. And yeah, privately I get a lot of support for the things that I'm saying. I think now I get less public disagreement with what I'm saying, but people do not refer to it so often. So I think beforehand, what would happen over the last few years, publicly people would disagree and privately they would agree with me. And this happened repeatedly over at least the last 5 to 7 years, if not a little bit longer. I think now what I'm finding is that very few people are really disagreeing publicly, but they're not always prepared to engage in the sort of subject matter that I'm bringing up. But privately, they say this is really important. They don't really disagree with me. Very few people I talk with disagree with the broad analysis and the numbers that I'm using. They don't necessarily like the language I'm using, and that's perfectly reasonable. I just make the argument that the language I use is in line with the numbers. If the numbers look very severe, then the adjectives I should use should match the severity of the numbers. And actually, I think that's what we've done as scientists, is we've had numbers that paint a very dire future, and then we've used adjectives to describe this to the general public, to the policymakers, that are not in line with what our numbers are suggesting. And I would argue the language I am using is much more aligned with what our analysis tells us. I think we are seeing a change, and I really wish we'd seen this change amongst the scientific community 2 years ago, because I think that would have been really helpful as we'd run into Paris. I think we'd have had a different set of negotiations going on now, a different mood music, a different set of language being used, or a different discourse. So I think, unfortunately, I think the shift in many people in the scientific community who are very perturbed and concerned about how the severity of the climate change situation is being underplayed. That is occurring. A lot of scientists are concerned about that now and are being a bit more vociferous about it. But I think, unfortunately, I think it's not going to have a big play in Paris. But I think it probably will start to come out much more over the next year post-Paris.
Is there anything I've missed that you'd like to add?
There's this point in the end that if we expect that the future is going to just look like an adjusted, incrementally adjusted version of the present or of the past, then I think we are going to be sorely disappointed. The future will be radically different from the present, and it will either be radically different because we have significantly, we've grasped the nettle and we've been prepared to make the sorts of changes that initially will be quite challenging socially and politically to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions, or a little bit further down the line, we will be faced with huge social and political repercussions because of a very significantly changing climate. The first of those means we have some control over the situation. We have some agency. We can make things go in the direction that we think is the most appropriate. The second of those, where we just let business as usual carry on with a few incremental adjustments, is that the climate will hit us in various forms all around the planet at different times. And the repercussions of that will be ones that we are always trying to sort of second guess and to fight against. And that is a much more chaotic, catastrophic future than the one of some controlled reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, or very dramatic controlled reduction in carbon dioxide emissions in the short term. But the future will be radically different from the present either way. One we have some control over and one we don't.
I'm hearing we can climb down off the cliff or fall off the cliff, and I'd prefer to climb. We've been speaking with Dr. Kevin Anderson. He's a world-known climate scientist, a professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester, and he's also the deputy director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research in the UK. His recent paper, Duality in Climate Science, is available in full, free, at kevinanderson.info. Find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
It's been my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. As the world hangs in the balance, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and I know cutting-edge radio when I hear it. I'm going to play you part of the Beyond Zero Emissions radio show on 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. Following discussion of the Climate Action March in Melbourne, November 27th, host Vivian Langford starts in-depth with David Spratt, co-author of the book Climate Code Red, and host of the influential blog of the same name. Then you'll hear from Dr. Colin Long, leader in the National Tertiary Education Union, and he champions workers in the transition away from carbon. Vivian's third guest is psychologist Lynn Bender from the group Psychology for a Safe Climate. The group starts off talking about the climate movement in Melbourne, which I find exciting, but trust me, it's not long before they dive into issues that affect us all. Here is Vivian Langford.
Okay, David Spratt's with us. And look, David Spratt, someone I admire, he's been a catalyst for getting real on climate for a decade. Me, with my delusions, I always find them quite quickly dispelled when I go to one of his talks. And since Climate Code Red, he has published reports and given hundreds of talks on bright siding and why it's a bad strategy to always tell the positive story, permafrost bubbling our way to the apocalypse. And he explains why there's no carbon budget left, really, and why 2 degrees is far too high. We shouldn't be even contemplating that. So welcome, David.
Yeah, thanks for the cheery intro.
Well, tell us about the diversity of groups mobilising around the Paris Climate Conference.
Well, look, the People's Climate March in Melbourne is coming Friday at 5:30 at the State Library. Is really in part an attempt by the climate movement to build more strength, more power. And in that, I think it's done well because we've got a whole lot of people signed up who we haven't seen before, who haven't been active before. One of the really exciting things is that faith groups have really come on board, and just yesterday, 8 faith umbrella groups in Victoria. So this is not individual churches, but umbrella bodies such as the Council of Churches, the Jewish Community Council, the Islamic Society, the umbrella bodies for Hindus, for Buddhists and so on, all signed on to a statement together. And this is unprecedented in Victoria. And I'll just read a couple of sentences because I think it really shows how it's changing and their commitment. And they say in this statement, "We stand together in our moral obligation to care for sacred earth, the most vulnerable people and all human life, as a gift entrusted to our common care as we are confronted by the growing impacts of climate change in all corners of the world. More extreme weather events disrupt food production and water security," what Colin was just talking about in relationship to Syria, "exacerbate hunger, cause economic insecurity and forced displacement." Syria again. "We share a common concern for nature and for global social justice, and are deeply concerned that climate change is a threat to precious human life and to the survival of humanity, unless strong and urgent action is taken to address the causes." And that's just one of the sectors that's come on board. So I think just let's give a sense that this is not the same old suspects of just a few greenie and climate groups. We've got unions, no. We've got these, we've got health workers, we've got bike riders riding in from Moreland and from Ceres. It's really going to be a very diverse and exciting event.
And we've always been talking about building the movement, and George Marshall came out here, I think, with the Psychologist for a Safe Climate, and he talked about talking to diverse people and how each little community has its own leaders who can talk to them in their own language. And so people who are coming from the Sikh community, for example, might have a sort of a Sikh sort of world view that their leaders can appeal to.
Look,
when they're talking
I can't get Catholic high school populations to come to the march, but
No, but the Pope can.
but the Pope and Catholic Earth Care and this statement and having a Catholic cardinal visiting from Honduras speak at the march can. And we know that messages work better when you trust and are familiar with the people who are giving you those messages, and that's why this diversity in organisation is important.
Well, David, can I just ask you, how can it be that all these groups that probably have huge amounts of things in conflict between themselves and within their groups, you know, ideological differences, they can all just write this statement that you've read out and agree on something such as, quote, a just transition to clean energy. How can they all be suddenly all on behalf of clean energy?
Look, the ideological schisms between various faiths would require several PhDs and many of Colin's colleagues to unravel, but there is common cause. They were having a discussion about what their interfaith banner should say, and the words care for sacred earth was something they could all sign off on. Now, the word care is really prominent in the Pope's encyclical, but care for sacred earth was something that all of them said, we agree with this. So, I mean, all these processes of bringing people together, despite their differences, is about finding common cause, common language, and common action. And I hope that's what we'll do on Friday.
So consider yourself very royally invited, listener, from faith group, union group, green groups. You don't have to be from any one of those. You can just be a citizen who's been thinking about this a lot. And you'll find, as Lynn said, some comfort in joining together with, I think, a very impressive big rally. It'll be one of those big ones.
Can I just give one very simple example? So there's a whole lot of feed-in events before the main rally.
Okay.
Bike riders coming from Moreland, from the mechanics at 4:30, coming from Ceres at 4:45. The unions, as Colin said, are marching down from Trades Hall. And the faith groups are having a little thing called a farewell to coal. With a coffin and a choir and all sorts of little things around the corner from the main march at Wesley Church at 148 Lonsdale Street from 5 o'clock on Friday. And they will all gather there, and various interfaith speakers will go through a set of words to say some things about coal, what our Pacific leaders have been saying. So all those leading events are on the website at peoplesclimate.com.au/Melbourne, and you'll see all these leading events listed if you want to join whatever is appropriate for you.
You seem to be getting quite excited about it. Look, for a veteran person of many progressive movements, and I know Lynn is too, how do you think the sheer numbers of this big march here and worldwide, and knowing that they're part of something that is worldwide, will change the people who attend? It just can't end with this one rally. It has to have some effect on those people to motivate them, activate them, let's say.
Look, I think when people go to really big events, there is a certain spirit or power that often is part of that event, and you feel special. There's all these other people there who agree with you. It's exciting. There's a real diversity in messages and people, and you're being part of something big, and knowing you're strong in numbers is one of the most empowering things you can do, and one of the most disempowering things you can do, as Lynn will tell you, is to sit alone at home and do social media for 5 hours a night. I mean, we live in a world of breaking down of collectivities, of individualism and selfies and so on. So this may be, you know, the anti-selfie rally, where we don't take photos of ourselves, but we take photos of really large groups of people making common cause.
Well, so Lynn, can I ask you, in terms of, you know, we have George Brandis putting again in front of Parliament the thing that calls, who tells people who take their very legitimate cause to not have a coal mine in their backyard to court, sort of vigilante litigation, like a huge oxymoron, green terrorists and so on. People are being vilified. There's a certain little closet group, I hope it's only a small group, within the conservative ranks who really hate what we're doing. They think this is, you know, some communist plot that is going to ruin all the projects of capitalism.
Well,
this rally included.
Well, they're protecting what they perceive to be their interests. But James Hansen, who's, I would call, quite a conservative scientist, got arrested over the tar sands. So did Mark Jacquard, who doesn't like me calling him conservative. I checked that I'd got his checklist right, which I had, but he didn't like conservative, so I had to take it out. But they're people who have been part of the establishment, if you like, that they haven't gone against the flow. They're not, you know, just objecting people for objecting's sake. So has Bill McKibben become a protester and activist? And using the law is totally appropriate. The law's there to safeguard the community and people's rights and the world, in fact. So to rail against the use of the law is absurd. I think it's quite worrying, because it's a tendency towards Now, can I say this? This is me. This is not 3CR. It's a tendency towards fascism when you take control of the state.
I'm sure that's been said on this station before now.
And you make laws about things that get in the way of your power. And so I would think it's quite outrageous. I think anyone should take it as a great honour to be called an echo, to find George Brandis criticising them for taking action. I think it's responsible. That's why I think we all should go to this march, because we're saying we're going to stand up and be counted. We're telling our children why we're doing it. I'm telling people no appointments this Friday, because I'm going to the march.
Good on you. Okay, look, David, I want to come back now to the hard stuff about Paris. These pledges that the nations have all put on the table, they will lead to a 3-degree plus warming. You know, Mark Wasdell calculates they lead to about 7 degrees of warming. I don't want to quibble about how much warming. It's all far too much. So we need some rigorous thinking. And can you give me, like, short answers, David, on this? Just yes or not even yes or no, but just quick answers, would you mind? Because I know you know this, like, very, very well. Can you just say, do we have enough scientific information for an emergency response?
Yes.
Do we need consensus among the nations to generate that response?
If you wait for consensus, you may wait a long time. What you need is leadership from countries and people who count.
What would an emergency response look like if there is no carbon budget left?
It would mean planning a really rapid transition. I think the first thing is you just cannot leave it to the market. John Schellenhuber, who's head of the Potsdam Institute in Germany and the advisor of the EU and Angela Merkel, the leading climate scientist advocate in Europe, says what we need is, and these are wonderful words, a controlled implosion of the fossil fuel industry. And that is something that's not going to happen by accident by the market. It has to be planned and organised. And as Colin's talk about, we have to think about the Labor Party and the investment funds and the new industries and have a way of doing that. And it's not difficult. It's saying no new fossil fuel industry to start with. Stop the subsidies, the up to $10 billion a year that Australia's putting into fossil fuels. Plan this controlled implosion and a just transition and new jobs and different industries. Build the new with that money we've liberated, and then sort out the problems that remain after that. I mean, these are concrete things that can be done if government intervenes and plans, because all rapid changes in society have been brought about by conscious collective social action, whether it be the Marshall Plan or the Japanese or Chinese transitions. These require collective social plan and will.
Okay. How can we go back below the 1 degree of warming that we've caused so far, if not beyond zero?
We have to stop emitting fossil fuels, and then we have to get rid of the extra stuff we put up there. Now, we know some ways to do that are limited in extent. We know that reforestation will draw it down. We know over long periods of time the ocean will take it down. We have to find the ways to get really large amounts of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And we don't know them all now. Terrible analogy. When they set out to build the atom bomb, they had no idea how to build one. But if you do the work, you'll find the answers. And this is one of those things where, and Schellenhuber says, research, 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 as well as stopping fossil fuels. And if you do enough of this work, we will get the answers.
Okay. Thinking about the Indonesian peat fires and the melting permafrost, which is a subject I never knew about permafrost until I read Climate Code Red, and that was the thing that I really took from your book. Permafrost, my gosh, when that starts melting and the methane comes out, we're really game over. So thinking about that, we've just seen it in Indonesia. Why are these climate changes not up for discussion at Paris?
Because the international political policy-making process is consciously delusional. It is not setting out to solve the problem. It does not start by recognising the science as it really is, not recognising the problem that it really is. You cannot produce an answer without elaborating the question. honestly, and they are not elaborating the question. They talk about carbon budgets being left when there's none. They talk about 2 degrees as being a reasonable target when James Hansen says it's a quote-unquote a recipe for disaster. So if you're not honest about the problem, you'll never get the answer, and that's what policymakers are doing because they do not want to rock the boat. Garnaut and Stern and all these people have said, we should do these things, but it'd be too disruptive to the market, so let's do less. And is this notion that we cannot do anything that's economically disruptive that stops the policy-making process from having an honest grip with reality, as opposed to Sheldon Hooper, who says we need a controlled implosion. That has a particular economic resonance. It means, sorry, it's not win-win. These industries simply have to go. And we've seen that renewable energy has been incredibly economic disruptive. I mean, in Germany, the large electricity companies have no share market value anymore. The 6 large companies, because they've been disrupted by this new technology. So we have to accept there'll be disruption and radical change. And that's what they can't or won't do in Paris.
Right. Colin, do you have anything to put in there?
Yes, very. I agree with everything that's been said. I think a very helpful analogy is to suggest that, in the 1930s, there were British arms manufacturers selling weaponry to Germany, and it would be like saying after the invasion of Poland by the Nazis that the British government would say to the British arms manufacturers, oh, well, we won't interfere with your trade in weaponry to Germany. We don't want to interfere in the market for that. We should just see how the market lets it determine whether you should sell weaponry to the Germans or not. I mean, we just didn't do that. We just said, stop it. You're not doing it anymore. And the scale of problem we're facing is something that requires something akin to a wartime mobilization and the sort of planning that took place to enable the Allies to defeat the Nazis in the Second World War. You don't leave it up to the market to just see, oh, it might go here, it might go there. And that is the fundamental problem. I think Naomi Klein discusses this very well in her, This Changes Everything, when she says, unfortunately, the real impact of climate change has started to become obvious to everyone over the last 30 years, precisely at the same time as neoliberalism took over the global political economy. And we can't deal with climate change while governments are under the thrall of neoliberalism and will let the market make all determinations. And that's why I actually go back to something that Lynn said a little earlier, which I slightly disagree with, which is I don't think politicians are often, they're not actually lying about things. They're actually, they just refuse, categorically refuse to do anything that interferes in the operation of the market. And that's certainly the case in Australia, and that's why, in the end, people will be disappointed by Turnbull, because Turnbull is a market fundamentalist. Abbott was a market fundamentalist. They'll get around to defending the market from different ways, where Abbott was much more disagreeable and aggressive. Turnbull is just a smooth-talking market fundamentalist, but there's in the end, they will both defend the market over the climate. And that's the fundamental problem that we have to deal with at a global level.
Yeah, look, I think that's exactly right. And the political process is always one of compromise.
Yeah.
It's always, there's A or there's B, so we'll find a bit of space in the middle. It's never saying A is absolutely necessary. And, I mean, many years ago I said, it's if these politicians think that you can negotiate with the laws of physics and chemistry. And you can't. This is the one thing when you cannot negotiate with them. They'll just roll over you with heat waves and record or El Ninos, and this year being the hottest year on record. And there's no negotiating with those laws of physics and chemistry. And that's the political disjuncture that you have in Paris.
I guess I agree with everything you're both saying, but I do think they're lying, Colin. I think they're lying by pretending that they're not putting the climate last, which is what they're doing. And they're going there with so-called climate policies that are going to do really well. And, you know, the direct action auction was a stunning success. Yeah. I call that a lie.
Yeah, sure.
And that they, you know, their concern in negotiating at the OECD is climate. No, it's coal. It's business. It's their backside, so to speak. Now, I call that a lie, and yes. I guess the big lie is that you can have an economy without an earth.
Yes.
And it sort of reminds me of a guy who's had a very bad heart attack. He's being wheeled into hospital. He says, I can't go to hospital. I have to go to a meeting. It's a very important meeting at the office. And, you know, of course, he's going to be dead if he doesn't go and have some treatment. So there is no economy without climate action. There is a better economy if we protect the planet as best we can. That's the truth.
Okay, well, I have one last question. We're nearly out of time, and I think David has to leave soon. But the next, I think we're talking about a global issue. We're talking about lack of really global leadership because all those leaders are national leaders. But there's a huge discrepancy between the poorer countries who are suffering the, you know, Typhoon Haiyan, the great floods and heat waves in Pakistan, and we any one of us in this room could name the terrible things that are happening. I was in Timor earlier this year and I met the minister and he said he was going to Paris just to claim loss and damage, you know, and this Green Fund will have to be paying for loss and damage to people who, and certainly to Pacific Islands. Now, Colin, I know you have some expertise. You're, in fact, a historian of the Asia Pacific. So could you tell us just something from your experience to bring it to life, that what it's like in those countries and how we can back them up in their arguing position at Paris, but also how we can then, as Naomi Klein says, have a Marshall Plan for the Earth where we make a massive transfer of expertise, like your trade union expertise and financing, to the poorer countries.
Yeah, that's a massive question. You know, I've been doing quite a bit of work around garment workers' rights in Bangladesh. So, you know, we're trying to defend to encourage the organisation of garment workers in Bangladeshi factories, and that's a tough job. I mean, garment workers and their unions members get killed over there if they try and get organised. It's that bad. But, you know, it also occurs to me that we could be achieving all sorts of great things for Bangladeshi garment workers, but it is one of the most vulnerable countries in the world to climate change and sea level rise, and they could lose it all just from the impact of climate change. So they really need, you know, those struggles need to either be in parallel, or the climate change one almost needs to be more important in some ways. So one of the problems, of course, with the Pacific and with Asia is that, you know, the malign influence or legacy of colonialism. So there's not a great deal of trust in the West in many ways, and, you know, it's justified. We're still trying to extract as much as we can out of the Asia Pacific. When I say we, most of the rest of the developed world. And then we have the other added problem of the growth of China and the very dirty growth of China. There is, you know, talk about how they're trying to introduce more renewable energy and cut back on coal, but it's still a long way to go. But then on the other hand, China and other poor countries do have a claim to try and improve the standards, the living standards of their populations. And fundamentally, I think what it comes down to, yes, we need to transfer wealth, we need to transfer expertise, although you'll be surprised at the expertise that is available in many developing countries already. But fundamentally, what we need to do in the rich world is say, we have too much. We can't continue to grow our economies and pollute in the ways we're doing, because some of these poorer countries need to grow their economies, and they will pump out some CO2 in the process of that to try and improve the living conditions for their people. But we can't continue to do that in the rich West. In fact, we have to decelerate very rapidly.
Mm, that's a nice word, decelerate. I would like to put us all on carbon rations, but
I'd like a controlled implosion.
What about you, Lynn?
I want people to get the true diagnosis, face the truth, and take action as much as they can on an individual level. Not leave it to others. Some of my friends, colleagues have said, oh, you're still busy with that climate march, as though it's sort of a little hobby of mine. I try not to flog it too much because I'll have no friends in the end. But the reality is that we aren't taking responsibility, individual responsibility, not in the sense that it's all our fault, but we're now responsible to do what we can. That's what we're responsible for.
Yes, well, our children and our grandchildren will ask us one day, what did you do in the great struggle against climate change? And we want to be able to say, well, we did something and we stopped it.
I don't think that's good enough. I don't care about what they say. You know, I really don't care about that. That's sort of, what did you do in the war, Daddy, that idea. It's so much bigger than that, Colin, I think. I don't really agree with that.
Well, but it may be the top end of town may come to understand that their heirs and descendants won't have a place in a hotter world either.
Mm.
Well, as a woman and a mother and a grandmother, it has a lot of, it motivates me greatly when I feel despair and like giving up, because I look at my grandchildren who trust me. I look at my grandchildren who I hope will have a good life. I look at my children and hope they'll get to live to be 68 like me and, you know, be living in a thriving world. I feel immense horror and sadness about their future, and I think we need to, that's the way we conceptualise the future, that's the way we conceptualise caring about the future. And it's our, you know, on a selfish level, it's always been our feeling of contributing to the future, making our lives have a point to them, not just as consumers and people who are left behind garbage and pollution.
Okay, well, I'm getting the sign off now. Thank you very much. That's been a marvellous discussion, I think. I hope the listeners, you've enjoyed it. Just to tell you again, the Climate March starts at 5:30 next Friday, the 27th of November. You can meet at the State Library in Swanson Street and bring your friends. If you can hook up with your union or your faith group, please check out their websites, because they'll be perhaps carrying banners or wearing special colours. I know the faith group are, you know, wearing all purple. If you need any more details, look it up on the internet on the peoplesclimate.org.au/Melbourne. That's for the Melbourne people. For the Australia-wide audience, there are marches in other cities. You just need to look up peoplesclimate.org.au. And we are joining with people worldwide to do this. And I thank our guests, David Spratt, Lynn Bender, and Dr. Colin Long, for giving us their hour of passion and telling us all about it, so that you will come along to the rally at least. But don't just come to the rally. Come prepared to activate yourself for the long haul, because I think it's more than our children and our grandchildren. I think it's really future species and the future of everything. So please come along. Thanks today to the radio team, myself, Vivian Langford, my colleague Jane on the panel, Teddy, Jody, Roger, Miwa and Glenn. And join us next week, Monday at 5:30. Maybe we'll have some guests from Paris.
Radio EcoShock.
There you have it. Lively climate radio from Beyond Zero Emissions, broadcast on 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. 3CR also broadcasts Radio EcoShock as one of our international partners. Hello to all our listeners there. Get links to Beyond Zero Emissions in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world. Here's a quick bit of music from the group Eclectic Sparks in Yorkshire, UK, as played at the Yorkshire Climate Festival 2015. The title, What You Gonna Do With Your CO2?
Weird weather, extreme events, like a strange experiment. Pumping out the gas without a care, like a crazy planetary dare. Yorkshire's rivers going up and down, flooding our cities, villages and towns. Butterflies and coffee moving up the mountain, 400 ppm and counting. You're in a greenhouse throwing rocks, opening up Pandora's box.
You may be short, you may be tall, gonna mess you up if you do nothing at all.
What you gonna do? What you gonna do with your CO2? What you gonna do? What you gonna do with your CO2? What you gonna do?
What you gotta do, you see O2. What you gotta do? What you gotta do, you see O2. Buried in the ground, gonna knock it in a pocket and lock it in a case, gonna crack it, frack it, send it into space, gonna wet it, sweat it, let it fall like rain, gonna eat it, to get it, pour it down the drain, gonna schmooze it, bruise it, put it in a hole, gonna leave it for millennia, turn it into coal, let's bless it, compress it, turn it into bombs, gonna shoot it, loot it, feed it to the dogs, gonna chase it, embrace it, grow it into plants, gonna throw it, blow it, stick it down my pants.
You may be short, you may be tall, gonna bless you.
What you gonna do, you see O2?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And I'll say at the top, you can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. And we're on the web, Taylor-Report.com. And there is Facebook/ The Taylor Report. I rarely mention that, but I know the zealots will find a way to find those sites. And with me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing,
yes,
Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
So we hope to be talking to a couple of people today, but one of them for sure is Fred Ziamana, and we'll be talking with him in probably about 10, 15 minutes. But Fred Ziamana is he's the coordinator of the survivors and victims of the 1972 genocide in Burundi. We often talk on this program about Rwanda. We also talk about Burundi. Burundi is experiencing a political crisis, most of it foreign-sponsored, in that France, United States, and Britain are heading up an effort to remove their hobby is regime change. When bored, they work to remove somebody's government because being democratic countries, they think that's their business. So at any rate, they're very zealous about targeting people, and they have targeted the president, the elected president of Burundi, over what is in fact a internal matter of the nation of Burundi, that is to say the constitutional means of succession, how many terms the president can serve and all that. That Burundi, to its satisfaction, has done that, but not to the satisfaction of Washington, London, and Paris. And they have various followers and associates who help them in this business. So they're challenging the Burundian government and trying to harm it, because the first thing they do is see if they can destroy the economy, prevent elected leaders or members of the government from travel. Freezing their assets, freezing the assets of the country. Anybody who knows anything about Cuba and the U.S. policy towards Cuba, which lasted on and on and on, and actually has not ended. On paper, it's ended, but that's the way the U.S. likes to operate, doing a lot of things on paper, and practice is another matter. At any rate, so that's a great, great concern because, in fact, certainly in Canada, they've all bought the leadership here. Has bought into it and is following along with that practice. So we're going to be asking Fred Ziamana about this because, after all, he's a Burundian. He might know something about the country as opposed to editors of the Globe and Mail and the Star. We have other news. And well, Phil, you wanted to tell us you have announced about your program. Phil Conlon is at Classical Underground's Wednesdays at 6.
Yes, and we're going to have a very rare treat on this week's program. Maria Rockwall is a historian and a musician who has researched and written a book on the subject of the Montreal Women's Symphony Orchestra. And you might say, who were they? Well, they were a group of women that, under the leadership of a native of Montreal, Ethel Stark, put together an orchestra in 1940, consisting entirely of women, because at that time, symphony orchestras simply did not permit women to play within their ranks. It was total apartheid, so to speak. And
You remember the theory that a woman aboard ship will cause it to sink.
Yes. Well, practitioners
same
of that
with
theory.
Mining. Right. If there's a woman in the mine, the mine will collapse.
Terrible things are going to
happen,
right?
Because God works in wondrous ways, his marvels to perform.
Oh, of course. And, of course, we in North America like to criticize what we consider backward attitudes among in other parts of the world. But that backward attitude permeated classical music culture. And So this orchestra was a response to it, and we're going to have the author in, and we even have some excerpts of the Montreal Women's Symphony Orchestra to play for our audience.
By the way, now that was an ongoing effort. There must be women who are there still some women with us who were part of that effort?
It doesn't seem to be. There seem to be only one or two still living, but I mean the orchestra did close down 50 years ago. And but there are many people who remember it, and it had quite an effect on their lives. You know,
that's a really important one. I hope we return to this many times over, because today in Hollywood they're talking about the absence of women producers of films and directors of films. And, of course, it raises yet a third question, which is race. No sooner did Meryl Streep say that, you know, how much she loves this battle, than someone asked her, are you interested in black women? Because they get excluded and they get given certain types of roles. Are you going to do anything about that? And no answer on that phone call. So anyway, that was – it's Phil Conlon. It's going to be Wednesday at 6 o'clock.
That's right.
And
Classical Underground.
Okay, Classical Underground. And this is the Taylor Report. We're hoping to get a feature on Syria, and we're struggling to do that. We're certainly going to talk about Syria, like right now. I just want to make sure we mention we're getting reports, of course, that the Russian effort there has shown significant advance. And I noticed that the Toronto Star has taken a new tack, and this is opposed to 4 days ago, 5 days ago. Now they have a photograph of Assad, President Assad, and they say that he reports that this progress is happening. It doesn't spend a lot of time laughing at him and saying he has to go and how fed up Canada is. It seems to be just a straight-up report while the editors, you know, drink some black coffee and try to get their brains straightened out as to what's been going on. And certainly all the world's leadership needs to do that. There's some heavy hitting going on at the United Nations. I really urge our listeners, please pay close attention to what is said there. I know that the Russian leadership has said to the British leadership, if you're going to show high dudgeon and an interest in getting going into the to Syria, then you're going to have to respect the sovereignty of Syria. That you cannot just guns blazing say, oh, because we are upset, we're going to enter another country. This is very important. There are two things about the Russian position. One, it has UN sanction. And two, it has Syria's sanction, which, by the way, two is more important than one. Syria remains sovereign no matter what the United Nations might think. And I would remind you that the People's Republic of China came into existence in 1949, but for the world body, it didn't happen, I think, until 1984. I think that they chose Orwell's year to explain why they'd been so damned ignorant that ignoring 1 billion people might have been kind of stupid. But China remains sovereign by saying, we're sovereign, so don't play with us. And it all worked out rather nicely, actually. And China, too, is upholding these points. What is really bothering the British, and this is where the pinch comes, and they can't avoid it. Both the British and the Americans and the French have been operating as though international law doesn't matter and the United Nations doesn't matter. They have not taken any of these big projects of bombing that blazes out of people to anybody. They've just done it. The last time they went to the United Nations and asked for permission, they got permission for a no-fly zone. And then the no-fly zone turned into a NATO fly zone, and NATO then destroyed Libya. Which, if you want, you know, there's always the important dates. If you want to look to a date that really mattered, that was probably one of the big ones, because the next time they asked for permission, everybody just looked at them. Certainly the world did, and Russia for the first. And according to Phil Conlon, we have 5 minutes to go, and I think we will, we're in good shape on that. Now, in the remaining minutes, oh, by the way,
can I just comment that the Globe and Mail ran an editorial about Burundi the other day, which was amazing because they haven't actually run any news stories. And the Globe evidently decided they're experts on the constitutional law of Burundi and that they have it right, along with their friends in Human Rights Watch, and the Burundian court has it wrong. And therefore, we all have to be concerned because never again and all this sort of stuff. Yeah. It was the most arrogant piece you can imagine.
Well, we go from arrogance to arrogance. We have the president of the United States who tells the president of Syria that he has to step down, that he's the problem. And, you know, by the way, I think President Assad's numbers of approval are higher than those of President Obama. I'm impressed with the humility of President Assad and other presidents, other leaders of countries who take this malarkey from the great powers without saying, actually, I'd like you to step down. And I'll give – you know, I mean, because the moment it would be uttered, everyone in the world would faint with – I mean, you can't say that. But it's okay that that someone can define a state as an exceptional state unlike any on the earth and then talk to other sovereign leaders as though they are – what is the expression? Liver or whatever it is?
Chopped liver.
Chopped liver.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
The whole world is chopped liver to chopped liver. To the empire.
They should do a cartoon. You remember the one you said New York City, you look at the – America, and it's just a cactus in San Francisco.
Yes.
Well, the U.S. looks out on the world, and it's all just chopped liver. At any rate, it's terribly insulting, and you're quite right. I mean, incidentally, I have no great respect for the American Supreme Court, which gave Bush the election when he lost it. But that's it. The Supreme Court said that. And it's understood that that's a domestic issue, and it's not for – somebody in another country to announce that the president of the United States has to step down. You know, you're quite right. That goes on. And, of course, I'm sorry to report that our new defense minister, I think it was, made a statement that, again, that Assad had to go. By the way, he obviously hasn't got the word because there's a lot of movement taking place and he'll probably change his line in about a week. But we are in an interesting and stormy situation. I want to point out that at the United Nations, the third committee plenary session on the 11th November, the 19th, that was Friday, at any rate, 8th Thursday, perhaps, they had a vote once again this year on whether on combating the glorification of Nazism and neo-Nazism and other practices that contribute to fueling contemporary forms of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance. The vote was 126 yes, 4 no's, and 53 abstentions. The 126, my goodness, I could list a whole lot of them, but Afghanistan voted for that. Algeria voted for it. El Salvador voted for it. Malaysia voted for it. The Solomon Islands voted for it. South Africa voted for it. South Sudan. Let's talk about the ones who said no. Ukraine, United States, and Canada. By the way, Israel voted for it. But in 1 year, 12 months of hard work by Samantha Powers and other vigorous, highly qualified, brilliant diplomats in the United States, after 1 year of hard work, they pulled a fourth vote into the group, Palau, which I think is about 87 people on a good day, and it belongs to the Americans. That's who they got. That's the four, the mighty four. They would not vote yes on a resolution combating the glorification of Nazism. That's two now. I think we ought to have a three-strike rule. You do that three times and you were definitely out. So that's two strikes. But it is really remarkable. And I wouldn't hurry, by the way some are, to say, I think I know why. It's just somehow domestic politics of Canada. I don't think that's it. It's foreign policy of the United States. And they have, it's true, a loyal friend in Canada. And they can tell you how they got that loyalty. And it's by staring. And after you've been stared at by them, you do what they tell you to do. If you don't, well, of course, they will tell you that you need regime change.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Cookett, Director of Global Climate Policy with the Sierra Club, who assesses what's at stake in the Paris Climate Summit and the role of the global climate movement. Julia Olson of our Children's Trust, who talks about the groundbreaking court ruling in a children's climate change lawsuit that affirmed the state's obligation to protect future generations. And Miranda Blue of People for the American Way, who examines the links between the toxic rhetoric of anti-abortion activists and GOP politicians and the recent murder of three people at a Colorado Springs Planned Parenthood clinic. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Palestinian poet Ashraf Fayyad, who is a leading figure in Saudi Arabia's contemporary art scene, has been sentenced to death by a Saudi court for blasphemy and renouncing Islam, a charge the poet denies. An international campaign of writers and human rights activists has mobilized to defend Fayyad, who has curated major art shows in Saudi Arabia and Europe. After a fierce argument 2 years ago in a cafe, the Saudi religious police, officially known as the Commission for the Preservation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice, investigated Fayyad's 2008 book of Arabic poetry titled Instructions Within. The poet and curator was arrested in early 2014 and was initially sentenced to 4 years in prison and 800 lashes. But prosecutors appealed, seeking the death penalty. A court imposed the death sentence in mid-November. Saudi Arabia has executed over 150 people thus far in 2015. The divisive case illustrates a growing cultural split within the Saudi kingdom between hardline conservatives and a growing number of outspoken artists and activists, highlighting the boundaries of free speech in Saudi society. The online newspaper Al Arabi Al Jadid, the New Arab, criticized the death sentence, insisting, "In these times of Islamic State, do we Arabs need further scandals involving slashing throats?" Life on Aboriginal lands in northern Ontario can be grim, with little drinking water, overcrowded schools, and decaying infrastructure. Over the past 55 years, Indigenous participation in national elections has been 20% below that of the general population. But that changed in October's Canadian election, which brought Liberal Party leader Justin Trudeau to power. Tribal leaders mobilized Indigenous voters in historic numbers after launching a 3-year-long effort. The campaign to boost the power of Canada's Indigenous peoples began in 2012. Tribal activists were angry when the then Prime Minister Stephen Harper limited environmental reviews of new pipeline projects on tribal lands. Meanwhile, the Tribal Council of the remote Attawapiskat Reserve declared a state of emergency over horrific housing conditions and lack of clean drinking water and electricity. In late 2012, a Facebook campaign called Idle No More grew into an Occupy-style national movement to educate Canadians about the plight of Indigenous peoples. Idle No More became deeply engaged in October's national election, investigating party positions on Indigenous concerns. Tribal communities saw a doubling of voter turnout in Indigenous majority districts in Manitoba and Saskatchewan that elected 10 new Indigenous members of Parliament. The morning after the vote, Derek Nepinak, the Grand Chief for the province of Manitoba, declared that Native people were now a force to be reckoned with. He asserted, "That giant is awake. A Liberal majority government is going to have to deal with a giant in the Indigenous people of these lands." 3 days before the anti-hunger organization Oxfam America published an expose on the U.S. poultry industry, Tyson Foods promised to raise the base wage of chicken processing workers to $10 an hour. Oxfam's report, released in late October, is a biting critique of four top poultry producers: Tyson Foods, Pilgrim's Pride, Perdue, and Sanderson Farms. These highly profitable food giants control a vertically integrated enterprise that has come to dominate a low-wage industry, meeting America's growing appetite for chicken. Production lines, staffed with a largely immigrant workforce, face increased risk of repetitive motion injuries to hands, fingers, arms, and shoulders. Oxfam's report, Lives on the Line: The Human Cost of Cheap Chicken, exposes the growing political clout of the Big Four chicken processors. The Poultry Industry Trade Association, the National Chicken Council, has sought to weaken government oversight of the chicken industry and resist antitrust, labour, and environmental enforcement initiatives. The prevalence of bad wages, unsafe working conditions, and anti-union practices detailed in the report comes as no surprise to the advocates working on behalf of chicken plant workers. John Whitaker, president of the Mid-South Council of the Retail, Wholesale and Department Store Union, says that while the report doesn't provide much new information, it is welcome to put public pressure on the industry to improve working conditions and raise wages. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
With the failure of past climate summits fresh in the minds of government officials and activists, leaders of 150 nations, along with 40,000 delegates from 195 countries, are participating in the United Nations climate talks that got underway in Paris on November 30th. Massive protests planned by climate activists for Paris have been banned by French officials in the aftermath of the November 13th terrorist attacks that killed 130 and injured 350 more. One contentious issue that must be resolved in Paris revolves around the question of whether or not to make any agreement that's hammered out legally binding. While the European Union and many other nations favor a binding agreement, President Barack Obama has only narrowly supported making periodic reviews of greenhouse gas emission reduction pledges legally binding, recognizing that the Republican-controlled Congress would almost certainly defeat a move to approve a fully binding new climate treaty. Another likely sticking point is the demand that industrialized nations help poorer countries that have contributed little to climate change but are the first to suffer its effects in the form of extreme weather and rising sea levels. Whether or not the nations gathered in Paris will achieve an agreement that limits a rise in temperature to 2 degrees Celsius over the pre-industrial climate is an open question. But a sobering new study published earlier this fall by the U.S.-based climate research group Climate Interactive found that even if every nation honored their announced carbon emission reduction targets, the world would still be headed toward a 3.5 degrees Celsius rise in temperature by the end of the century, an increase that scientific research predicts can lead to crop failures, food shortages, and widespread plant and animal life extinctions. Your reporter spoke with John Cookett, Global Climate Policy Director with the Sierra Club, who talks about what's at stake in the Paris Climate Summit and the role of the global climate movement in pressuring governments to take concrete action to address the causes of global warming.
Well, I think that at this point it's pretty clear that the world's leaders have learned from the mistakes of the past in climate negotiations and have established a framework that is much more likely to be successful. Already we've had almost 180 countries representing 95% of global greenhouse gas pollution come forward with plans. We have strong statements from over 100 world leaders today talking about Paris as a starting point and talking about the obligation to future generations. The fact of the matter is the UN and the leadership there and the leadership of the United States, China, India, and other countries understand that they needed to do things differently, and what we're seeing now is the fruits of those labors over the past year or so. Particularly successful conversations between the U.S. and China that resulted in really early pledges by those two countries over a year ago that then proceeded to unlock contributions from all these other developing and developed countries.
John Cookett, in advance of the start of the Paris Climate Summit, key nations, and you just mentioned China and the U.S., of course, pledged to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that cause global warming. Do these pledges that have been laid out in advance of Paris go far enough to address the urgency of climate change?
Well, there are sort of two ways to look at these. From a political basis, and when you think about how important it is to really get the entire world acting on climate change, these pledges are incredible. They represent a tremendous departure from our inability to get the world focused on this in the past, and they are going to result in unprecedented efforts to address climate change. But of course, the math doesn't lie, and it's very clear at this point that without continuing acceleration of these efforts, we will not avoid dangerous climate change. So it just partly it depends on how you look at it, and partly it depends on what comes next. Paris is a really important turning point, but it is absolutely not the end of action on climate change. And we saw that in many of the leaders' statements today. Everyone seems to understand how important this is, and no one is pretending that Paris alone will solve climate change.
What is the Sierra Club's criteria for success in Paris at the end of the day when that summit concludes?
I think the most important elements are the elements that point us towards what's going to happen next. And will countries come back to the table to pledge further reductions? I think actually the president put it pretty well today. He talked about whether we're creating an enduring framework instead of a stopgap solution. And I think what we're looking for is something that is an enduring framework. The main things that we're looking for include evaluatory processes that bring countries back in to strengthen their pledges every 5 years. These are, some people are calling them sort of cycles of review. But the important thing is that beginning in 2020, countries are brought back to make additional pledges so that those emission reduction targets can accelerate. The other thing that's really important is that we have a robust verification process to make sure that all countries are doing what they said they would do. If we don't have the opportunity to evaluate whether they're doing what they said they would do, it's not going to be as strong an agreement as it needs to be. So those are the main pieces. And then, of course, we're looking to see countries step up and offer more finance to help other countries take action and also to help them adapt to climate change. So there's a lot of reason to believe that once we get going in earnest, we can accelerate these reductions. The fact of the matter is that the pledges that exist right now are not sufficient to solve the problem.
That was John Cookett, Global Climate Policy Director with the Sierra Club. Find more news and analysis on what's at stake in the Paris Climate Summit by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the past several years, lawsuits have been filed in several states against the U.S. government, demanding that officials take action, specifically to protect children from the impacts of climate change, as they and their descendants will be the ones affected most. James Hansen, perhaps the best-known climate scientist in the U.S., who first testified before Congress on the issue back in 1988, has provided expert testimony in some of these cases. On November 19th, King County Superior Court Judge Hollis R. Hill in Seattle issued a groundbreaking ruling in the case of eight youth petitioners represented by the Western Environmental Law Center, who requested that the Washington Department of Ecology write a carbon emissions rule that protects the atmosphere for their generation and those to come. While the judge denied the children's petition to force the state to adopt stricter regulations, she wrote, "The youth's very survival depends upon the will of their elders to act now, decisively and unequivocally, to stem the tide of global warming. Before doing so becomes first too costly and then too late." Judge Hill ruled that the public trust doctrine mandates that the state act through its designated agency to protect what it holds in trust. In its decision, the court validated the youth's claim that the scientific evidence is clear that the current rates of greenhouse gas reduction mandated by Washington state law cannot ensure the survival of an environment in which youth can grow to adulthood safely. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Julia Olson, executive director of Our Children's Trust, the group which brought the lawsuit, along with claims in several other states. The children the trust represented in Washington state are members of a global environmental youth organization called Plant for the Planet. Here, Olson describes the significance of the ruling for these children and for similar cases pending across the country.
So one reason why the decision is slightly confusing is because of the procedural posture of the case. So basically, if you look at what the young people were trying to achieve from the beginning, it was they wanted their state to engage in a rulemaking to set limits on carbon dioxide emissions. And they wanted their legal rights to be protected, their rights to healthy public trust resources and their constitutional rights to live in a healthful environment. And what they got at the end of the day are both of those things. But the way it came about is a little bit nuanced. So basically, because the governor, during the course of the litigation, ordered the Department of Ecology to start the rulemaking, that took part of that remedy away from the court. So the court at that point didn't need to order a rulemaking because the department had already agreed to start one. But what the kids still needed was they needed the court to tell the Department of Ecology that it had the law wrong, because the Department of Ecology was saying that they didn't have to protect the environment for these kids, that they weren't public trustees that had to help address climate change. They were denying all of those legal arguments that the youth had brought to the court. And so the court gave the kids the second piece that they needed. So basically, she said, I can't order them to do a rulemaking. They're not acting illegally anymore on that piece because they're doing the rulemaking. But I can tell them what the law requires them to do. And I'm going to clarify for them that they are public trustees. They need to address climate change and ocean acidification in the state of Washington. They have a constitutional obligation to act and protect these kids' rights. And that when they act, it needs to actually consider science. And so that piece of it is an enormous win for these youth and for everybody in the state of Washington.
Well, climate change is obviously a global problem. So how will this ruling impact climate change, and how will it help to protect these children?
Climate change is absolutely a global problem, but the solutions lie at the level of the state or the nation state. So we don't have a global government that can order something to happen around the world. You know, we have a process where every country and every state is responsible for what happens within its jurisdiction. So we need every state and every nation around the world to do its part to reduce emissions in order to stabilize the climate system. And Washington is one piece of that. And it's why youth are going after other states here in the United States, and why they have a lawsuit against the federal government, and why kids are starting to sue other governments around the world as well, because every government has a job to do.
Julia Olson, I know there have been other lawsuits along these lines, but this is the first successful one, yes?
Yes, that's right. So this is the first time the young people have actually gotten the remedy that they were seeking, which is the rulemaking to set limits on carbon emissions and the declaration of their legal rights by the court.
Can this ruling be used as precedent in these other cases? Do you think it helps significantly to move these other cases forward, including the federal lawsuit?
When a district court or a lower court makes a decision, it's not binding precedent on other courts or on other states, but it is really persuasive to other judges to see how a court in a particular jurisdiction has addressed the issues. And the fact that this court has been really clear that the young people's survival is at stake, that you can't protect navigable waters of a state if you're not also looking at the connectivity between the atmosphere and carbon pollution and its impact on those waters. She's made some very powerful rulings in her decision, and that will be persuasive to other courts across the country and the world.
That was Julia Olson, Executive Director of Our Children's Trust. For more information on the group's climate change lawsuits on behalf of children, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Fifty-seven-year-old Robert Louis Steer is charged with launching a November 27th attack with a semi-automatic rifle on a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs, Colorado, that killed three people, including a police officer, and injured nine more. Although the motive for the violence isn't clear, Deer was quoted by investigators as talking about baby parts, a likely reference to a campaign by the Center for Medical Progress, which released a series of deceptively edited videos that accused Planned Parenthood of harvesting aborted human baby parts and illegally selling fetal tissue to medical researchers for profit. Although those allegations of illegal conduct have been denied by Planned Parenthood officials and widely debunked by state investigators, Republican politicians and presidential candidates have cited the videos in an effort to defund Planned Parenthood with a threat to shut down the government if legislation to do so wasn't signed into law. GOP presidential candidate Carly Fiorina has been widely criticized for spreading misinformation about the videos, and Texas Senator Ted Cruz has come under fire for his welcoming an endorsement from a prominent anti-abortion activist who calls for the execution of abortion providers. Vicky Cowart, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Rocky Mountains, said in a statement, quote, "We share the concern of many Americans that extremists are creating a poisonous environment that feeds domestic terrorism in this country. We will never back away from providing care in a safe, supportive environment that millions of people rely on and trust." Your reporter spoke with Miranda Blue, senior researcher with the group People for the American Way, who examines the links between the toxic rhetoric of anti-abortion activists and GOP politicians and violence targeting the Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs and elsewhere across the country.
So we don't know much at all about his connections, if he, you know, where he got his information, if he was working with any other groups, if he was radicalized by any particular other anti-abortion activists. But the evidence that we have so far points to this being what it appears to be, which is an anti-abortion terrorist act, which falls in, sadly, a tradition of terrorism at abortion clinics in the U.S.
There has been a connection made by Planned Parenthood
between the action of the shooter at the Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs with a lot of what they characterize as the toxic rhetoric coming from anti-abortion activists as well as Republican politicians, and particularly some of the GOP presidential candidates running for their party's nomination. Tell us a bit about some of the things that Planned Parenthood is concerned about in terms of the rhetoric coming from these folks.
Sure. I mean, so I want to be careful about blaming something like this on any particular person or any particular set of ideas. But I think that it's very true that, especially since this latest attack on Planned Parenthood started, there's been this effort in the anti-abortion movement and then the movement supporters in the Republican Party to demonize Planned Parenthood to a really new extent, to paint it as what Ted Cruz calls a criminal enterprise, and to claim that instead of providing women's health care, as everyone who has been to a Planned Parenthood knows that's what they do, that instead it's this sinister evil organization that is getting rich off of selling the parts of babies, you know, and this is all based on a lot of lies and misconceptions, but this is the image that they're trying to paint. And in the process, what this has done is, in many ways, it's revived the more radical fringes of the anti-choice movement. For a long time, the movement's been sort of moving towards very dangerous but incremental legislation and efforts to shut down clinics and make it harder for women to access abortion. And this has been a mostly legislative process, and it's been cutting off abortion rights to a great extent, and it's a big problem. But this Planned Parenthood story has sort of moved the narrative back towards the more extreme rhetoric where you are attacking women, individual women, for going to a Planned Parenthood clinic. You're standing outside the clinic and yelling at women and really demonizing the individual people and the individual organizations that provide this procedure. That's an interesting part of the response that a lot of Republican presidential candidates are having to this, where they're saying this is a terrible thing. I don't condone this at all, but they're saying, trying to pretend that it was just a random act that happened to take place at a Planned Parenthood clinic, and ignoring the history of violence that's come with the radical fringes of the anti-abortion movement. And I think that's a troubling response that I hope that the media will call candidates out for.
Miranda, it may be worth reminding our listeners that this incident in Colorado Springs is not a rare act of violence among those folks who oppose abortion. Place in context this latest incident at the Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs with the attacks and murders of abortion providers and other staff at similar clinics across the country.
Sure. So, I mean, as I'm sure the listeners sadly know, there has been a long history since the 1970s when really the abortion debate sort of blew up into a huge political debate rather than a debate within the medical community. There's been a long string of attacks and attempted attacks on abortion clinics and on abortion providers. I believe it's 8 people have been murdered before this event last week. 8 people have been murdered in connection with anti-abortion terrorism. There have also been dozens of people injured and over 100 arsons at Planned Parenthood clinics. And so this is something that we've seen before. And the people who do these things have different ideological influencers. But the ultimate goal of all of these is to not only hurt individual abortion providers and individual people in these clinics, but it's the goal of all terrorism to make people scared of, you know, in this case, becoming an abortion provider, becoming a receptionist at an abortion clinic, or going to an abortion clinic or Planned Parenthood for any other purpose to get health care.
That was People for the American Way senior researcher Miranda Blue. Learn more about the pattern of violent attacks targeting Planned Parenthood clinics by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis
of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Tale of Two Men. Sometimes events occur which, although separate in locality, have features in common, or when compared, reveal a clarity that they would not possess apart. Cases in point. A. A young man, reportedly for the high crime of possessing a 3-inch knife, gets shot repeatedly until dead. His alleged offense, causing fear in a cop. B. A middle-aged man, armed as if about to engage in war, drives to a Colorado Springs abortion clinic and engages in an hours-long rampage, shooting 9 and killing 3 before quitting his tantrum and submitting to arrest. Upon arrest, he is neither beaten, nor kicked, nor stomped, nor shot. I am, of course, referring to the cases of Laquan McDonald, 17, late of Chicago, Illinois, and of Robert L. Deere, 57, of Colorado Springs, site of a Planned Parenthood clinic. One, it must be said, black men receive hyper attention when in the presence of cops, so much so that, as a rule, white guys fade into the background of normality, unseen, unchallenged, even when they are carrying arsenals. Again, as in Deere's case, he drove to the clinic and then carried arms into the site of Planned Parenthood. One man was virtually invisible. Another man was hyper-visible. In such cases as these, both paths led to disaster. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Now, Laquan. With a name like Laquan, we can safely assume his blackness, of middling height, perhaps 5'2", with a weight of 130 pounds or so. Laquan bounces down a Chicago avenue with typical teenage abandon. He seems more like he's skipping than running, his right hand holding a penknife of some 3 inches or so. One can almost feel the buzz of youthful testosterone rushing through his veins, a subterranean river of strength, assuring him that he is invincible, that he can punch through walls, get hit with a mountain and rise. And then, without warning, a shot rings out, and it spins him like a top, 360 degrees. He falls. An unfamiliar pain grips him, curling him, folding him into a fetal position, cradled by the cold earth. Then, like heartbeats, come death beats of bullets, and 17-year-old Laquan McDonald is no more. He is but the latest black body blasted into oblivion by a white Klansman in blue. His once unknown name joins a chorus of the dead: Tamir Rice, Mike Brown, Donald Dante Ivy, Eric Garner, Oscar Grant, Freddie Gray, and more, victims all of one of the oldest maladies on the American mainland, white fear. A 3-inch blade, legal, by the way, and 16 shots burned into the body of a teenager. For a year, the cameras go dark until a freelance journalist fights and wins a Freedom of Information suit against the city of Chicago. The camera replays that savage moment of a boy skipping his way into death. There has been an arrest, yes, but don't be surprised if there is also an acquittal. Any city that can make a murder disappear for a year can surely hustle up an acquittal. Only sustained struggle can make a difference. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. As the UAW strike against Kohler continues in Wisconsin, the union says a Kohler UAW Local 833 Workers Relief Fund has been set up to help strikers most in need. To donate to that fund, contact UAW Local 833. Donations can be either material, like food,
or it can be cash. The Kohler strikers have gotten support from other union brothers and sisters across Wisconsin.
My name is Kurt Brower. I'm the business rep for IBW Local 494, Kettle Moraine area. We also encompass all of Milwaukee area. Here showing support for our UAW brothers. Stick together. You know, united we stand, divided we fall. So,
I am Debbie Anderson from the USW, Harley-Davidson, Menominee Falls. I'm out here to support the picketers. I'm here to support the union cause.
The Teamsters' unfair labor practice strike against Coca-Cola refreshments is on, with more than 300 Teamsters hitting the picket lines early Thursday morning. Teamsters Joint Council 25 spokesman Will Petty says that the company was stalling and not bargaining in good faith, and they allowed the labor contract to expire without a new agreement.
Teamsters Local 727 has been trying to negotiate a new contract for 319 production and warehouse workers and transport drivers with Coca-Cola refreshments. They work at two facilities in Niles and Alsip, Illinois, and unfortunately, the company has engaged in one delay tactic after another to prolong these negotiations, stretch them out without any real intention of reaching a fair agreement. And that right there is the root of so many of the unfair labor practice charges that Local 727 has filed against the company.
Paul McHugh is one of more than 1,000 SEIU nurses fighting to defend their health care benefits at Pomona Valley Hospital Medical Center in California. SEIU 121RN did an informational picket at the hospital on Tuesday. If hospital management succeeds in having the nurses pay more for their health care, veteran nurses will get just a 1% pay raise. McHugh says morale is high among the SEIU nurses as they push for a fair contract that keeps their health care benefits intact.
In the end, it's taken away from our wages and our benefits. At a time when we need health care for all, we need to stand up for what we already have, not allow any corporation or organization to take away your health care benefits when it's something that should be a fundamental right.
With strong political and campus support, Columbia University's Graduate Workers of Columbia UAW Union is rallying on campus Friday. Union organizer Paul Katz says they're urging the university to respect the democratic choice of the grad students to organize a union. Katz says a strong majority of the grad student workers support the union.
From the moment we went public a year ago, we've enjoyed strong majority support. We've built networks across all of the departments on campus.
Workers Independent News provided by Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
What is behind the rash of police violence against African Americans? How is it that police killings like those of Michael Brown or of Laquan McDonald can be conducted with almost complete impunity for the offenders? Are there substantive links between police brutality in Minneapolis and the flourishing of white supremacist groups there? In what ways have the freedom struggles of the 60s and 70s been successful, and where have there been failures? What are the historic roots of the problem of racist violence against Black Americans, and where do solutions lie? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we examine the phenomenon of racialized policing in Minneapolis and throughout the United States, as well as the recent explosion of anti-racism activism conceived to confront that violence. Our guests for the hour include Michelle Gross, activist with a Minneapolis-based police watchdog group, and commentator Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of Pan-African Newswire. On this week's show, Black Lives Matter, investigating the culture of impunity of racist police violence in the United States. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 4th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Illegal oil revenues are one of the main sources of income for the terrorists in Syria. According to some reports, they make about $2 billion a year on illegal oil trade. Turkey is the main destination for the oil stolen from its legitimate owners, which are Syria and Iraq. Turkey resells this oil. The appalling part about it is that the country's top political leadership is involved in the illegal business. President Erdogan and his family. That was from a speech given by Russian Deputy Defense Minister Anatoly Antonov during a December 2nd briefing. Transcribed in the article, Bombshell, Russian Military Reveals Details of ISIS-Daesh Funding, Turkey's Role in Supporting the Terrorists, Complete Transcript, Videos, Documents, by Syrian Free Press, posted December 3rd. A statistical analysis performed by George Kyorksoglu, visiting lecturer, University of Greenwich, London, and Dr. Alec D. Kutrubis, principal lecturer, University of Greenwich, London, determined that, quote, It seems that whenever the Islamic State is fighting in the vicinity of an area hosting oil assets, the 13 exports from the Turkish state-owned oil refinery at Ceyhan promptly spike. This may be attributed to an extra boost given to crude oil smuggling with the aim of immediately generating additional funds badly needed for the supply of ammunition and military equipment, unquote. And Zero Hedge has rounded up a variety of circumstantial evidence indicating that the Turkish leaders are intentionally smuggling ISIS oil into Turkey and then out to the Mediterranean using the same supply routes used to smuggle illegal Kurdish oil. Will the Turkish president keep his word and resign? That comes from the article, Yes, Turkey is Buying Oil from ISIS, by Washington's blog, posted December 2nd. As Mehdi Mahassan points out in The New Statesman, quote, if bombing worked, Iraq would have morphed into a Scandinavia-style utopia long ago, unquote. Instead, the country is in chaos, breaking records for terrorist activity while ever more foreign fighters flood into the country day by day. In other cases, like Syria, the connection is less clear. What is accepted, even by American intelligence agencies, is that after the deaths of hundreds of civilians and thousands of fighters from coalition bombs, Daesh, or ISIS, is certainly no weaker now than it was a year ago. In fact, its fighter ranks may have swelled from 20,000 to 31,500 to at least 80,000 in the past year. That comes from the article, The Entire War on Terror Has Been a Lie, and These Charts Prove It, by Rebecca Sumner, posted December 2nd, originally appearing at The Canary. In September 2014, a photo of Netanyahu and Ya'alon visiting terrorists receiving care in an Israeli hospital went viral online. Netanyahu seen shaking a terrorist's hand. According to the Al Arabi Al Jadid newspaper, quote, Israel has in one way or another become the main marketer of ISIS oil. Without them, most ISIS-produced oil would have remained going between Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. Even the three companies would not receive the oil if they did not have a buyer in Israel, unquote. In October, Iraqi security forces captured an Israeli colonel, Yuri Ulen Shahak, working directly with ISIS terrorists. That comes from the article, Israel Supports ISIS, by Stephen Lendman, posted December 2nd. The problem that Turkey faces now is that the Russian-led coalition is rapidly destroying the infrastructure that provides funding for ISIS, oil refineries, fields, and transport, while gradually retaking territory that was formerly controlled by the many anti-regime or al-Qaeda-linked groups in the north, west, and central parts of the country. In the last few days alone, Russia and company have concluded the encirclement of Syria's biggest city, Aleppo, vaporized a convoy of over 500 oil trucks in the vicinity of Raqqa, and intensified their bombing in the Turkmen Mountains, the Kurdish Mountains, and the Prophet Jonah Mountains. The coalition has moved as far north as Azaz along the Turkish border and recaptured the strategic Aleppo-Raqqa highway, which completely cuts off ISIS supply route from the east in Raqqa. All of the recent progress comes in the wake of the retaking of the strategic Kuwaris airbase, which was the tipping point in the 4.5-year-long conflict. Now the Russian coalition has focused on closing the border, a move that will sever vital supply lines to pro-Turkish militias operating in Syria and force the terrorists to either flee or surrender. That comes from the article, Putin's Revenge, The Fight for the Border, by Mike Whitney, posted December 2nd, originally appearing at Counterpunch. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Black Lives Matter was spawned in 2013 as a social media hashtag following the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The movement continued to gather momentum in 2014 following the deaths of 18-year-old African-American Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and of Eric Garner, a Staten Island, New York native, both at the hands of police officers. While this anti-racism activism may not have resulted in justice for the multitude of slain African Americans gunned down with impunity by police officials and vigilantes like Zimmerman, the movement at least seems to have raised awareness among citizens inside and outside America of the depth of the problem of racialized justice in the states. Minneapolis, Minnesota may serve as an important case study of this phenomenon. On November 15th, Jamar Clark was fatally shot by police. Multiple witnesses reported Jamar was shot while handcuffed. Anti-racism activists had set up a protest encampment outside the 4th Precinct, demanding the release of the video footage of the killing of the 24-year-old Clark. On Monday, November 23rd, alleged white supremacists fired at unarmed protesters, wounding 5. As this program is being put together on Thursday, December 3rd, the encampment has been taken down by police using bulldozers, and 8 of the protesters have been arrested. 200 Black Lives Matter protesters have taken their demonstration to Minneapolis City Hall. The Global Research NewsHour recently caught up with a longtime activist involved in campaigns to confront police brutality in the Minnesota metropolis. We approached her to get some explanation of the context of police violence being conducted against African Americans and other persons of color in her city. I'm joined right now by Michelle Gross. She is with a group called Communities United Against Police Brutality, a Minneapolis-based police watchdog group. Thank you very much for joining us, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, could you just give us a little bit of background on Communities United Against Police Brutality, how it came together and how it functions?
Sure. We have been together, working together for 15 years. Our organization came together because there had been organizing around police brutality every year in the Twin Cities. There's an annual National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality on October 22nd, and we had been organizing for some years. Around that, one of the people who spoke at the event, a man named Obuka Sanders, who was well known in the community because he was involved in the spoken word movement. And he was well known. He spoke at our event. And then 8 days later, on November 1st of 2000, he was driving home from working overnight as a personal care attendant for a terminally ill man. He was tired. He was driving the car home so his wife could take the kids to school. And the cops said he was driving erratically. They boxed him in, and they gunned him down. 37 shots. This man was unarmed. And, of course, the community was very inflamed. So we started, you know, doing the Justice for Buka Sanders thing. We were having protests and sit-ins at City Hall and all of that. And along the way, it occurred to me that the way we were doing this work, by waiting for something bad to happen and then reacting to it, was all wrong. We needed to be much more proactive in terms of, you know, not having to recreate a movement every time something happened, but also in dealing with the day-to-day abuses that lead to the conditions that allowed those bigger incidents to occur. So that's kind of the forming basis of Communities United Against Police Brutality. We're an all-volunteer group, but we've been doing this successfully for 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, my understanding is that Minneapolis, or in Minnesota, has the highest or among the highest rates of over-prosecution of blacks in the entire nation. Do you have any insights into what's anything unique about your neck of the woods?
Yes, and you're absolutely correct. We do have the highest rate. We're the state with the highest rate of over-prosecution of blacks in the entire country. And our jails are by far the blackest place in our state. And more than that, what's led to this situation is, you know, a lot of people here want to pretend that this place is very liberal and very nice and all of this kind of stuff. But the reality is that this is a very, very racist state. It has racist institutions. This was the state that also historically had the largest massacre of American Indians in the entire country. you know, historically. So we have a long history of, you know, of slaughters of people of color here, and you know, detrimental actions toward people of color that ruin people's lives. You know, here, like I said, our jails are just, and prisons are just littered with people who, you know, mostly drug war victims and things like that. And so, you know, we've got a huge problem. A big part of it is that this is a very white state. Statewide, African Americans only make up 3% of the population. Now, in the Twin Cities, African Americans make up 14% of the population. So it's, you know, but it's still a, you know, a small segment of people that experience the, you know, the wrath of the whites, if you will, you know, how you want to put it. But they, you know, they really are the victimized by these, just these institutions and systems that perpetuate racism.
And I understand the city of Minneapolis has paid millions upon millions of dollars settling cases of police brutality over the last decade and a half.
Oh, yes. Every year, our city, we have 850 officers, sworn officers, and every year our city pays out at least $3,000 in judgments and settlements per officer, you know, which means, and it's not all the officers that are doing it, so it means there's a segment, we figure it's in the neighborhood of about 150 to 200 officers that are the most problematic and that cost the city the most money. But yet, even though the city is happy to pay out these settlements and judgments, they are not at all willing to hold these police officers accountable. You know, there's no consequences for the cops for doing this stuff, and that's why it goes on.
Mm-hmm. And so the courts, they're not holding the police agencies accountable, and that points to the idea of judicial impropriety. Has there been complaints leveled against the Judicial Standards Board or some other oversight body?
There is no point in this system anywhere where, in which police will be held accountable. We'll start with the city itself. We have what we used to have a civilian review authority, and they were not very effective because they weren't given the power or the finances, you know, the resources to do their job. But at least they did sustain some cases. They were never disciplined, but they were sustained. And then, you know, that was at least something. We have been placed now in the last 3 years. The city got rid of that, put into place a thing called the Office of Police Conduct Review. In 3 years, they have heard well over 1,000 cases. Not one single case by a community member has been sustained and disciplined. Not one in 3 years. Now, I'm sorry, you can't tell me that over 1,000 people are liars. That's just wrong. You know, so that starts the problem. Then, when people are brutalized by police, they're inevitably arrested and charged falsely with obstructing legal process, disorderly conduct, you know, fifth-degree assault on an officer, which is like you could breathe in the guy's face and get that charge, you know. Just, you know, anything like that. They put these phony charges on people to attempt to justify their brutality. And what they know in the United States is that we have a U.S. Supreme Court decision called Heck versus Humphrey. If you go down on criminal charges in the incident, you have no lawsuit. So this is an attempt to basically prevent a lawsuit. And so people end up, you know, going down on criminal charges, or they make a deal or something like that, and then their lawsuit flies out the window. So this is their whole risk management strategy. The bottom line is that it's a misuse of the criminal justice system to try to cover for the officers. The judges are more than willing to go along with it because they believe anything that comes out of a cop's mouth, like it's the Bible or something, and they don't believe things that come from the community, even though they hear them over and over again. And so the judges are biased, very biased, and it just goes on from there. The Post Board, we have a thing called the Post Board here, which is the Peace Officer Standard and Training Board. It's the licensing agency of the police. You can file complaints with them, but they fall into a black hole. They go nowhere. We filed 31 complaints with them about grotesque corruption, massive theft by their licensees. There was a whole thing called the Metro Gang Strike Force. It was already exposed and like in a report that was done by the state attorney general thing. You know, this thing where there was proof that they stole people's cars, they stole money, they brutalized people, they stole their property. And these people had committed no crimes whatsoever. This was a massive criminal enterprise by the police. We filed 31 complaints, you know, on behalf of 31 victims, and the Post Board did nothing with them. you know, these people engaged in felony conduct, and the Post Board did nothing against their licenses. So every point in the state where you go to try to get some, you know, accountability for this conduct, at every point the system deliberately puts up roadblocks and deliberately fails to hold police accountable. The situation that happened with Jamar Clark was pretty much inevitable because the system has never held police accountable in this community. And now they're about to try to let these cops walk. I don't know if your listeners know that. They have now announced that they're going to put this in front of a grand jury. And grand jury, when you say I'm going to put it in front of a grand jury, that's code language for we're going to use the grand jury to give ourselves political cover for not bringing charges against these cops. In 150 years, not one single police officer in the state of Minnesota has been indicted by a grand jury for harming a member of the community.
Mm. That's very interesting. I just wanted to like follow up on your previous comments. You're talking about the roadblocks. I'm wondering if it goes beyond that. I mean, like retaliation against complainants like yourself. Is there any examples you might want to evoke?
Many. While we were in the middle of pursuing our complaints about the Metro Gang Strike Force, you know, this criminal enterprise, one of the individuals who was one of our complainants suddenly found himself being, you know, followed and the cops showing up at his house all the time. We've had many acts of retaliation. We worked with a case where people, you know, had gotten brutalized the night before on a Sunday night. They went down to City Hall the next morning thinking that they could walk into Internal Affairs and make their complaint. They didn't know that you shouldn't do that because it's a bad idea and that there's retaliation. As they were driving home, the same officers who brutalized them the day before, followed them home and brutalized them again. Yeah, there's many incidents like that.
My goodness. And what about white supremacist organizations? Do you see them flourishing in Minneapolis?
They're the kind of ugly underbelly that a lot of people don't want to acknowledge here. Back in 2001, I was part of an organizer that we called Can the Klan, Can like put them in a garbage can. And we, the Klan, the National Socialist Movement, and the all three branches, the skinheads, all three branches of the white supremacy kind of movement in the U.S. came together in the Twin Cities to attempt to have a rally and to do some recruiting in Minnesota. But their plan was essentially to go to all the whitest states in the U.S. and try to form a stronghold. And we had an extremely effective event. Over 4,500 people came out to oppose these people. But they still have had gotten some legs under them here. And these guys, four of them, actually plotted and planned and attacked the encampment that people had formed outside the 4th Precinct. So they attacked this encampment. They shot activists. They shot people. You know, five different people were shot. They literally just strafed the crowd with bullets. It is lucky that no one was killed. It is lucky that more people were not injured. And yet, you know, we have these, like, you know, mass shootings that happen at, like, movie theaters and everything, and everybody gets up in arms about that. But people seem to be fine with people gunning down people at a protest. And, it's really quite outrageous. It's one of the most egregious things because we're talking about gunning people down for exercising their First Amendment rights. And yet, you know, the cops have not taken it seriously. The charges they leveled against these avowed white supremacists who actually, plotted this and openly plotted what they were going to do. I mean, we have emails showing where they were talking about who's going to wear what and which guns to bring and all this stuff. So it was planned in advance. That's first degree premeditated murder attempt. And yet these guys have gotten really low-level charges put on them. It's so outrageous. And they're saying, we can't charge them with hate crimes because we can't show it. Well, why can't you show it? I've got the emails. How come you don't? You know, I'm trying to put these in the hands of law enforcement, and they're not interested in getting them. So it's just such nonsense. It is so clear that white supremacy is just down to the core of the institutions in this area.
Yes, you've outlined some outrageous dynamics, and I'm
You talked about a grand jury coming down, and it's fairly well understood that this is kind of like a kind of a cover-up type situation where nothing is actually going to get done. How do you see the community reacting to this? Is it going to be more of the same? Is there anything you can disclose about where things go from here?
There's a lot of actions being taken and going to be taken to apply pressure to the county attorney to force him to not use a grand jury. You know, I don't know if that's going to be successful or not. I think we need to do that. It must happen. There's also a separate investigation that's happening by the FBI, but we aren't really convinced that that's going to be all that valuable because they're doing all the interviewing of the witnesses in tandem and meaning that they're going to get, you know, we don't think that they're really doing a good job. The main agency that's doing the investigation for the state is called the BCA. Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which is like the state version of the FBI.
Could you repeat that? I don't think we quite caught it.
It's called the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and it's about the same as – it's like a state version of the FBI. But most people here call it Bureau of Cop Assistance because, you know, basically they're going to want – they never hold police accountable. They have screwed the community over and over. No one trusts them. No one believes that they're going to do a good job. And people are starting to have big doubts about whether the FBI is going to do a good job. There's a lot of concerns about that. So, you know, we don't think it's going to be a real great investigation. And even if they were trying legitimately to do a good investigation, the investigation has already been tainted from the start because in the immediate aftermath of this event, 30 to 40 squad cars descended on the neighborhood. This is a small community. 30 to 40 squad cars, almost all white cops, came barreling out of the cars, pointing guns at people's faces, pointing tasers at people, pepper spraying people, basically, and stealing people's cell phones. So, you know, witnesses are definitely afraid to come forward. You know, I don't even know who all has shown up at these for witness statements because I've talked to several people, two people in two completely separate circumstances told me the identical story that a cop ran up to them, snatched their cell phone out of their face, out of their hands, put a gun to their head and said, "You better not tell what you saw here or you're going to end up like that kid over there," referring to Jamar Clark. So, you know, we know that there's been an enormous amount of witness intimidation in this case. And so that has tainted the investigation from the very beginning.
Hmm. You tend to think if organized crime was running the city of Minneapolis, would you notice a difference?
Really, you know, they might gun down less black folks, you know, honestly.
Okay. We're almost at the end of our time. Are there any other details or facts of significance you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, again, you know, this is a systematic problem. You know, many people always want to talk about, well, there's bad cops and there's good cops. I always think it's important to point out it's not about bad cops or good cops, but it's about a bad system. And it's a system that refuses to hold police accountable. And when you have a system like that, it's a toxic mix because it ends up causing people to causing police to feel like they have impunity to do this. So no, it's not every officer doing this. It feels like it's close to the Wild West, but it may not be. But the bottom line is that we have a system that is so completely and utterly dysfunctional, and not just dysfunctional, but willfully dysfunctional, and not holding police accountable, which means that what you have is state-sanctioned violence. And that's, you know, the reason why we are working so hard to get at these underlying causes of this problem. There are some solutions. We are working hard on those solutions. One of the main ones we're working on is requiring police officers to carry their own professional liability insurance so that they would have a personal consequence if they engage in this conduct. You know, if they cause their insurance company to pay out more money, their premiums are going to go up, or they might become uninsurable and we can get rid of these guys. So there are solutions that we're working on. This is a very intractable problem. It's a hard problem, but we, like I said, we are working on solutions. And people, you know, I hope people will get involved, and wherever you live, get involved. You know, your listeners can look up more information at www.cuapb.org.
Michelle Gross, thank you very much for sharing those insights with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Michelle Gross is an organizer with the Communities United Against Police Brutality, a Minneapolis-based police watchdog group.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We'll air an interview with prominent African-American essayist and commentator Abayomi Azikiwe in just moments. But first, we'll play a song. Here's legendary recording artist Gil Scott-Heron with the song "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised" from the 1971 album Pieces of a Man. Stay tuned.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from the Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Report from 29th District. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
A string of racially charged incidents involving police brutality and impunity for law officials has galvanized Americans by the tens of thousands to stage demonstrations and civil disobedience actions across the U.S. The hashtag Black Lives Matter has come into prominence and is waking up all races within and outside the continental United States to the ongoing reality of racial disharmony and social inequality in what's called the land of the free and the home of the brave. Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Jamar Clark, just a few names on the roster of those killed in cold blood with no acceptable punitive actions taken against the offenders. Add to this the high incarceration rate of men of color, and it becomes clear that there are systemic problems affecting race that need to be addressed and confronted. To help contextualize the epidemic of police and legal violence against the people of color, we're joined by Abayomi Azikiwe.
He is the editor of Pan-African Newswire, an outspoken and frequent commentator on issues of African and world affairs. Many of his essays are published at the Global Research website. It's good to have you with us, Abayomi Azikiwe.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so I was wondering, first of all, what are we to make of this phenomenon? Are we talking about, just something about our law enforcement system that attracts racists, or is there some sort of like a conscious conspiracy to subdue and criminalize people of color from the beat level on up to state agencies like the FBI? What is your take on that?
It's a combination of both. You have a system that was born in racism, in genocide, in forced removal. And therefore, in order to maintain that system, a state apparatus was put into place in order to oppress as well as contain those who were the center of this form of exploitation. If you look at the forced removal of the native people of the United States, it was done over a period of approximately two centuries in a very brutal and a very dismissive fashion. The importation of millions of people of African descent who were brought into the United States as slaves from 1619 all the way up to the illegal abolition of slavery in 1865, the entire political economy of the United States was based on forced removal, enslavement, and super exploitation. We look during the so-called antebellum period. That's the period after the independence of the U.S. From Britain up until the Civil War. The major engine of the economy was the production of agricultural goods and later on, particularly cotton. And as a result of the production and exploitation of cotton, that slavery flourished inside the United States, particularly in the South, but it had also been very widespread on the East Coast as well as other parts of the country, even in the Midwest. I believe that this factor plays into how African people, African Americans, are perceived by the ruling interests inside the United States. Even after the conclusion of the Civil War, the failure of Reconstruction, which lasted at least on a federal level for approximately 12 years, and then on a state level, it was able to survive up until the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries, you still had institutionalized racism. There was lynchings. There was close collaboration between groups such as the Ku Klux Klan and local law enforcement agencies. You had courts and you had laws that specifically were designed for the repression of African Americans. Even today, some 50 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, there is massive discrimination and oppression against African Americans. It has come to the light very starkly in the last 3 years with such high-profile cases as the vigilante killing of Trayvon Martin. There was the police killing of Michael Brown in 2014. Also, the killing of Eric Garner. And the most recent upheavals centered around the shooting of Jamar Clark in Minneapolis and the release of a video of the killing of McDonald, Laquan McDonald in Chicago, 17-year-old African-American youth that was shot 16 times as he was walking away from the police. So these are how these reasons are connected to the history of the development of the United States all the way up until the present, where, of course, we have the police who are reinforcing this same system of national oppression and super exploitation.
Now, the extent to which these killings have become national news, is that a reflection of some kind of a resurgence, or it's been going on all the time? It's only now that the cameras are out and it's getting as much attention as it's getting. What is your sense of that?
Well, the FBI does not necessarily keep records of the police killings of particularly African Americans in any type of systematic and efficient way. You've had publications that have done studies, leading U.S. publications that reveal that thousands upon people have been killed over the last two decades by the police, not only African Americans, but people from other national minorities as well as whites. I think now there is a system that is developing among community organizations, non-governmental organizations, certain periodicals and journals that are doing a better job at documenting the frequency and the severity of these killings. Also, the advent of social media, the internet as well, allows people to communicate even in a media framework with millions and even billions of people instantaneously. So there's a greater awareness. There's a much better form of communication between activists, those in the communities, and also communications outwardly towards the national and international community. Now, what we've seen in the last 3 years, it appears it is a rash of intolerance and brutal and deadly force being exercised by the police. This is happening from rural areas all the way to small towns and suburbs such as Ferguson, Missouri, which only had 21,000 people living in it, to Baltimore, which is a major municipality in the southeast, to Minneapolis, where over the last two decades, a lot of African Americans have migrated there from Chicago and other cities in the Midwest due to the shifting economic character of the United States. I believe that there is a greater awareness, a greater sensitivity, and we've seen the struggle against police brutality and police killings, in a sense, merging with a new movement coming off of the campuses, starting at some of the most elite universities in the United States, the University of Missouri at Columbia, Princeton, Georgetown, Brown University, which have had demonstrations led by African-American students against institutional racism, against symbols of racism. For example, at Princeton, demanding the closing of the Woodrow Wilson Center. And there's been numerous demonstrations all across the United States targeting buildings that are named after former slave owners. Presidents such as Woodrow Wilson, who were ideological racists. I believe that this level of sensitivity and activism and organization and mobilization is going to continue because the federal government, along with the corporate community, really has no program to address these issues. If we look at the actual economic status of African Americans, they lost tremendously during the Great Recession beginning in 2007, 2008, and actually the losses began much earlier than that because of the so-called dot-com boom collapse of the early 2000s. During the Great Recession, African communities lost their homes to the hundreds of thousands in states like Michigan and other areas throughout the United States. And they have not recovered from that. You have an unemployment rate in the United States where African Americans have twice the rate of joblessness than the national average. You have to look at the level of social wealth, household wealth, accumulated household debt. All of these factors are contributing to this degree of intolerance and also anger that is rising among African Americans.
Mm. So then do you see a correlation then between economic hardship and economic inequality and these gestures of police and judicial violence?
Yes, because the focus from a public policy level has been on the elimination of crime in major urban areas and also in suburbs and even in rural areas. And African Americans are identified as being disproportionately involved in criminal activity. They are targeted specifically for that purpose, and as a result of that, they are overrepresented in the prison industrial complex. So you have, from a proportional standpoint, far more African Americans incarcerated in the United States than you do whites. That doesn't mean that more African Americans use illegal drugs. They commit crimes, but they are treated differently by the courts. They are racially profiled. For example, the federal government did a study of Ferguson and St. Louis County last year, which they released. It was entitled the Ferguson Report, and it indicated that local municipalities in St. Louis County were deliberately targeting African-American motorists for being stopped, for being issued three, sometimes four citations per stop. And as a result of that, you had approximately 12,000 outstanding warrants against mainly African-Americans in a city of 21,000 people. So that was an average, it was calculated by the New York Times, of two outstanding warrants, a lot of which are derived from traffic citations per household in Ferguson, Missouri. I mean, it was a huge aspect of the federal government's report on Ferguson. And despite all of this, the government said that there was still not enough probable cause for the police and the local municipal officials to be prosecuted under federal laws. Now, they did apparently make some arrangements for these people, higher-ranking officials, the police chiefs, some people involved in the courts, that they would resign in exchange for not being prosecuted. However, this phenomenon is not just centered in Ferguson, Missouri. This is a pattern that can be replicated all across the United States.
I was wondering if we could go back to the movements of the 50 years ago, the 60s. You had the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee right up through the rise of the Black Panthers with these same issues out in the open. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to maybe briefly assess what have been the successes and the failures of those movements of 5 decades ago in confronting institutional racism in America.
The success centered around the passage of legislation, as I alluded to earlier, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But what is often not known by many people is that there was an attempt to pass a civil rights bill in 1966 that would have guaranteed fair housing and an elimination of housing discrimination and other issues in the United States. Well, what was happening in 1966? This was after the Watts Rebellion of 1965. During 1966, there was urban rebellions in dozens of cities across the country. The slogan Black Power became extremely popular inside the United States. It contended with the more what was considered mainstream or moderate slogans and demands as advocated by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference under Dr. Martin Luther King. These developments pushed King further to the left. So by 1966, he was calling for much more stringent measures on the part of the government. Now, mind you, this was after the passage of these two major civil rights bills the two preceding years. In 67, there were even more urban rebellions. They reached their highest level with over 164 urban rebellions, according to the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorder that was impaneled after the Detroit Rebellion of 1967. And, of course, King came out solidly against the war in Vietnam. He linked the war in Vietnam to the failure of the United States to address its own internal problems, to eliminate poverty, to thoroughly eliminate institutionalized racism. He also looked at U.S. foreign policy and essentially declared it as being imperialistic. He was killed in 1968 while he was in Memphis working with sanitation employees who were seeking recognition as a trade union. So we can see that King himself was moving more to the left. He never abandoned nonviolence per se, but who knows, if he had lived, he may have become more aligned with Black Power and some of the revolutionary movements that were evolving at the time. The Black Panther Party, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Republic of New Africa, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, all of these organizations saw the need for a fundamental transformation of U.S. society. That movement was attacked as well by the federal government through the counterintelligence program, which influenced local police agencies to target their activists and organizations, round them up, put them under false charges, utilize the media to denigrate their efforts. And, of course, this had a tremendous blow against the movement overall. And then at the same time, there was an opening up of the political structures inside the United States. So they utilized the notion of the ability to integrate within U.S. society through running for public office, opening up new job categories to African-Americans. Those who weren't willing to accept that could face either death by the police, framing by law enforcement agencies and the courts, or many, of course, being driven into exile as well. These are multifaceted methods that have been used over the last five decades to contain and also suppress the African-American people, not to mention the rapid increase in the prison industrial complex, the 500% increase in the number of people who are incarcerated in the United States over the last 3.5 decades. These are serious issues, and they are not given attention, even by the White House that is now run by a person who is of African descent. There's been no major public policy initiatives launched by the Obama administration to do anything to correct the structural unemployment among African Americans, the high rate of incarceration, the level of militarization of the police, and also the fight to stop this type of racial profiling and victimization by law enforcement.
So that brings us up to the movement of today with Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter. How would you assess it? Do you see it as enduring, as being resilient, or is there some signs already of it being, I don't know, contained or co-opted or otherwise thwarted?
It's not a uniform movement. There have been efforts to turn it into a more systematic and organized force, but it's really not possible at this time because it just evolved 3 years ago. But it's part of a broader struggle, a struggle to bring about the realization of the unfinished quest for civil rights, human rights, national liberation, economic equality. You have different political tendencies within the anti-racist movement in the United States at this time. So it's going to have to play itself out in the streets, on the campuses, and in the workplaces. And we see that taking place in a myriad of fashions right now. So we're looking forward to how the movement is going to take on these monumental issues. For example, last year, people started to march into shopping malls, particularly during the holiday seasons, which is a very, very important time period for the capitalist system here in the United States. We saw an escalation of that last weekend during Black Friday, where in Chicago they were able to shut down for several hours the so-called Magnificent Mile retail district. Thousands, largely African Americans, but others, were able to block store entrances. And this, of course, had a tremendous impact on the politics in Chicago and also nationally. The sales were down across the country because African Americans had said through social media, through urban radio, that people should stay out of the malls as long as the police are not respecting our right to exist, to due process. So it's having an impact on the bottom line of the system. This week, Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff under Barack Obama and now the mayor of Chicago, announced the forced resignation of Chicago's police superintendent, and also the establishment of a task force. Now, what real impact this is going to have in the long run, of course, may not be very much, but it shows that even with limited organization, that the situation is so critical, and that the overall system inside the United States is so fragile now in terms of its economic status. I mean, we hear a lot of propaganda about the recession being over and about the recovery being strong, but if we look at the actual data, and even some of the leading periodicals in the financial community know that the so-called recovery is extremely, extremely fragile, and that any extended racial explosion or outbreak of unrest in key urban areas across the United States could be devastating, not only to the image of the United States, but also to the overall social stability of the country.
I wanted to ask just maybe if you could comment about perhaps less spectacular forms of racial violence. I mean, not necessarily police killings, but you know, more subtle forms, such as you know maybe the power dynamics in the classroom, portrayals in the media, maybe the representation in the labor force, and so on. Are there things that you would advise the movement to pay attention to that may not make the headline news, as it were?
There have been attacks on public education in urban areas. The lessening of funding by the federal government as well as state governments for education in urban areas, the massive laying off of teachers, the charterization of public schools, the attacks on teachers' unions, also the lessening of federal revenue sharing monies coming into the cities, causing the closing of recreational centers, the privatization of municipal services, the forced bankruptcy of the city of Detroit in 2013 and 2014 was heavily racially oriented, the whole approach. Detroit is the largest populated African-American municipality in the United States. It has a tremendous history of African-American civil rights, black empowerment, also labor rights. Many of the organizations in the 20th century were started in Detroit. The Nation of Islam was started here. The Republic of New Africa was started in Detroit. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers was started in Detroit. Detroit had the largest urban rebellion during 1967, prior to any other time in the history of the United States. So it's not an accident that cities like Detroit, cities like Chicago are being targeted for these privatization efforts and efforts to further disempower oppressed people.
Okay, I just want to maybe conclude with one last question, and you kind of alluded to it with your comments about King moving in a more radical direction toward the end of his life. And that has to do with that umbrella, that capitalist imperialist order that's, overseeing all of this. Can racial justice in America be successful attained without that capitalist imperialist order, or must that structure by necessity be toppled?
I believe that the U.S. has to transform economically and politically out of the capitalist imperialist system into socialism. And I think that that is the only way you can really tackle this problem. The current system being structured the way it is cannot at this point institute the type of reforms that were even carried out 50 years ago during the 1960s, where after the Detroit Rebellion in 1967, Ford Motor Company set up hiring centers in black communities where they brought in thousands of people to work. No multinational corporation right now inside the United States is in a position to hire tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of people who are unemployed or underemployed. So this is the major contradiction that we face right now, that the system is such that it cannot effectively reform itself, even under massive pressure. So I think that the next step will be a further erosion of the stability of the system, and that has to be matched by the degree of organization and coordination and mobilization on the part of the oppressed, along with all people who are for fundamental change to bring about a new era in U.S. history.
Well, Abayomi Azikiwe, I really appreciate your sharing your thoughts and insights with us on this very special and topical subject. Thank you for joining us.
And thank you.
We've been joined by the editor of Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikiwe. He's an outspoken and frequent commentator on issues of African and world affairs. Many of his essays are published at the Global Research website. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.